prepare yourselves for Ethan and Aaron's Confessions of a Movie Snob, the ongoing discussion of film
genres.
Hey,
and welcome to the podcast. I'm Aaron. With me, as always, is Ethan.
Howdy.
Howdy, howdy. Hey, hey, hey. How are you today, sir?
Jai Hulut.
Jai Hulut. I have no idea what that means. Is that some Star Trek shit?
No, it's from Dune.
Oh, okay. Ooh, gross. Dune. David Lynch. Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
Not good. Not good. Tonight, we should have an interesting show for you because we are talking with our longtime friend, many-time guest, Mr. Christopher McLaughlin. He'll be back after the break.
Yes, I've missed you for so long, Nutter Butter. I mean, Christopher. Yes.
Christopher, whatever you want to call it. You call your Nutter Butters Christopher, and you stick them in your mouth.
I do.
Ew.
Ah.
But yeah, we're going
to
be talking.
If he listens to this episode, he's going to be all kind of weirded out by
Let's hope so.
That's right.
You were telling me earlier how you want to lick his ears and stuff. It was gross. It was gross.
Uh-huh.
But we're picking a Christopher choice. We're talking remakes and reboots. It's something he was not looking forward to doing at all.
Nope.
And he probably meant it as a joke, but I don't have any sense of subtlety. So I'm like, okay, let's just do that. So we have that coming. But before we do any of that, we have a little segment we like to call Geekly Happenings. Ethan, the site was blocked out today. What the fuck was up with that?
Gamers Haven Podcast, CantCon, and the Confessions of Movie Snob site were all blocked out today. We were joined by some other smaller places like Wikipedia and
Google,
and you know, real minor places. Like
yeah, and our shit.
But we did it in support. Today is obviously January 18th. When we're recording this, and we're doing it in support protest of SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act.
Right.
I
knew what that. What is and the, what's the other one? The PICA.
Yes.
I don't remember what that one. I knew the abbreviation PICA. For SOPA. PIPA.
Protect IP Act.
Okay. Yeah. What is this, and why are we protesting it, Ethan?
Well, SOPA is an originally proposed bill that allows the U.S. Department of Justice as well as copyright holders to seek court orders against websites accused of enabling or facilitating copyright infringement. Now, depending on who makes the request, the court order could include barring online advertising networks and payment facilitators from doing business with the allegedly infringing website, barring search engines from linking to such sites, and requiring internet service providers to block access to such sites. The bill would make unauthorized streaming of copyrighted content a crime, with a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison for 10 such infringements within 6 months. The bill also gives immunity to internet services that voluntarily take action against websites dedicated to infringement while making liable for damages any copyright holder who knowingly misrepresents that a website is dedicated to infringement.
Now, why would we be protesting something that would stop people from stealing shit? Because isn't stealing wrong?
Because it's the whole key thing about this SOPA thing is it cures the disease by killing the patient.
Ah, we don't like that.
It not only does it step on First Amendment rights of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, etc. It also puts into the hands, from what I understand, it puts into the hands of, it says copyright holders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that means like studios could come in and say, oh, hey, Confessions of a Movie Snob, you guys mention our movies on your show.
And you say Little Shop of Horrors sucks, and we can sue you.
Sucks, and you know, you say things like, you know, you use little movie posters here, you post movie posters with your reviews. We don't like those reviews, so we're going to get an injunction against your website, have it blocked by the internet service providers, meaning anyone who has, say, Time Warner Cable can't look at your site.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that that is dangerous.
It is dangerous. My thought about it was and I don't understand politics. I hate politics. I abhor politics. But I was trying to explain this to Rachel today because, you know, I told her that we blocked out the site, and she's like, you know, what is it? And the way that I'm able to justify blocking it, the protest in my mind is I likened it to basically what it's doing is it's protecting bad business models.
Yeah.
And the way I explained it to her was the copyright holders, i.e. Movie studios, music studios, et cetera, software and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they're a dead and dated business model because, you know, it's much easier, it's more convenient to be able to stream a movie or whatever, and there is the flip side of that coin to where if you can stream it, you can duplicate it. Yeah. And that's where you get in trouble because you're streaming and you're torrenting movies. But I tried to explain it like this. Imagine that they decided that, and I don't know which is more economically viable. But we'll say the government decides that, you know, that staples are the way of the future. That's mm-hmm. the way that they want shit to go. And then the paperclip comes out, and they make paperclips illegal to protect the stapler companies. And that's the way that I see this. One of my thoughts about it is, yeah, it could suck for, I don't know, I don't even know any, but it could suck for BitTorrent clients. It could suck for, there's websites out there that stream television shows that are below the radar. And, you know, you shouldn't be stealing this shit. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't steal anything. But the problem is it's going to affect stuff like Wikipedia. It's going to affect stuff like Confessions of a Movie Snob. It's going to affect stuff like that much larger. Google. Yeah. Google. I mean, it's going to affect stuff like that.
When you go to Google, you want to punch in your search and you want to get the results and then you want to sift through them. You don't want some outside entity saying, well, you don't need to see these.
Right.
These, you know, you don't need anything from the New York Times.
Right.
You know, it's the same thing as saying, hey, I see you have, you know, the Harry Potter movies over there on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as saying, okay, well, we've declared now that those Harry Potter movies that you bought, you can only watch them once.
Mm.
If you try to watch them again, we're going to come over to your house and smash your TV.
Right. That's
you
not good.
You still have the DVDs, mind you, because you bought them. The DVDs are legally yours, but you can't watch our movie.
Right. It's fucked up. I mean, when it comes down to it, it comes from when you bare bones. It's not a bad idea because, you know, obviously you do want to stop theft and stuff. You sort of want to stop theft and stuff like that. I say that because, you know, one of the reasons why they justify price hikes in movies and shit like that is, you know, because, you know, we're losing money because people are downloading movies. That's a load of bullshit. Everything gets more expensive whether it's stolen or not.
Yeah.
It's not good. And I do think I'm proud that we were able to, you know, throw our little tiny hats in the ring as well and get rid of it. But, you know, today, you know, one of the things I did is I threw it on our Twitter feed, email your senators to say, you know, fuck this shit, don't do it. And so I decided, well, you know, I might as well practice what I preach. And so I go to email our senators. And what happened to me, Ethan?
Turns out that the Senate has decided to do its maintenance on its servers today, and they're not accepting emails.
Yep. Ain't that a bitch?
Ain't that a coinky ding?
Yeah, isn't that a coinky ding? Yeah. But does it matter right now?
No, it doesn't. Well, currently, no.
Currently, no. It does not matter. And why is that?
Well, you've read the story. I have not.
But okay. Well, basically, and I'm going to say this because I skimmed the article, and basically the head of the article states that Barack Obama kills SOPA. And I read over the article as quickly as I could because I found it right before we started recording. Mm-hmm. And basically what he's saying is he is not gonna allow anything like that to go through. And granted, we have checks and balances and stuff in our legal system, our government system, that makes it to where, you know, chances are this is probably going to get pushed through. But right now our commander-in-chief says no. You know, this is not the way it should be, and he says some of the same things that I am. Is, you know, ultimately this is just going to harm the little people, and it's going to make the fat cats richer. And I read, you know, very briefly said that if it comes down to it, he will use a veto against it. So that's cool. I mean, you know, good on him. I hate politics, and I don't really have an affiliation, and I'm kind of disgusted that we had to talk politics on our show, but. That's cool. I mean, obviously, you know, there's still lots of politicking that can happen to, you know, push this shit through, you know, but for right now, we have a pretty big cat in our corner, and we have, like, the President of the United States says, you know, no, this isn't cool, and that's kind of cool to me. I like that. So, you know, as of today, as of January 18th, the President says no. Man, next week, we might not have a next week, because, you know, something bad might happen, and they might shut down the whole thing and push through the act.
The article in the Huffington Post says, President Barack Obama entered the fray over two controversial anti-piracy bills with the January 14th statement aligning the White House with technology and internet community critics. of the legislation. The statement put the president on one side of the major debate between two of the biggest donor communities in the Democratic Party, the technology and internet industry versus the movie industry and recording companies. His position on it is that the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA, in the House and the Protect IP Act in the Senate hints at the increasing role played by computer and internet companies, their executives, and their employees in the Democratic Party coalition. Since 2007, executives and employees of such companies have given $52 million to Democracy Party efforts, up $12 million from the second period of 2006, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, there you go.
Yep, so that's good. I didn't understand a word you just said.
Nope.
Basically, no, what he's saying is...
Essentially what it says, the January 14th statement says the president will not support, quote, will not support legislation that reduces freedom of expression, increases cybersecurity risk, or undermines the dynamic, innovative global internet.
Saying that would do exactly that.
So, thank you, President Obama.
Yes, thank you, President Obama. Now let's move on to shit that we love. Enough politics.
Let's talk about something that all geeks know and love, and that's George Lucas.
Yay! Are we going to be talking that article I just pulled up?
Probably.
Okay, well, let's talk George Lucas.
He says he's retiring.
Yep.
We've heard this before from him, but he says tells New York Times that Red Tails is his last big project at Lucasfilm. He says, I'm retiring. I'm moving away from the business, from the company, from all this kind of stuff. The newspaper adds that the 67-year-old George Lucas was careful to leave himself an out and wanted to leave himself an out clause for a fifth Indiana Jones film. However, Lucas said, "Once this is finished, he's done everything he's ever wanted to do." Said Rick McCallum, "He will have completed his task as a man and a filmmaker." The Times says that Lucas has decided to devote the rest of his life to what cinestates in the 1970s used to call personal films. They'll be smaller in scope, esoteric in subject, and screened mostly in art houses. They'll be like the experimental movies Lucas made in the 1960s, around the time he was at USC film school, when he recorded Clouds Moving Over the Desert and made a movie based on E.E. Cummings' poem, on an E.E. Cummings poem. We're all guessing you'd still be involved in projects like Clone Wars cartoon, possibly live-action Star Wars show, and 3D conversions of the Star Wars movies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was quoted in saying, this is an interesting quote I pulled from another article, was...
Was it from the comic book resources quote?
No, it's, why should I make...
Why would I make any more Star Wars movies when everybody yells at you all the time and says what a terrible person you are, exactly. Lucas asked. That is the quote of the year, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's something that... I've been saying for a fucking decade.
I mean, the prequel trilogy is what it is. It's grown on me. Even the second movie's grown on me, okay? They are by fucking no means the stab yourself in the face, god-awful, you know, rape your childhood movies that some people make about
it.
And I've said it before, and I'm going to reiterate it right now. I admire George Lucas for what he does.
I do, too.
The man has a vision, he gets it done, and he does it the way he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not the vision you want... Fuck off.
Yep. And good on him. You know,
And fuck you. I liked Indiana Jones 4.
I did. I loved Indiana Jones. I can't fucking wait to watch it again tonight. But, you know, my thing... Okay, here's... And, you know, fuck my soapbox. I'm on my soapbox because... Mm-hmm. This fucking irritates me to no end. Because... There's a popular sentiment, George Lucas raped my childhood.
Yeah.
Okay. And the movies,
and that was a bandwagon. That was a trend for a while after episode two,
one
came
one.
Was people went George all over. It's like, oh, George Lucas doesn't know. He's freaking crazy, blah, blah, blah. Get over it.
Okay, my thing about it is, okay, yeah, there's special features and Greedo shot first and blah, 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 blah.
Whatever.
Ultimately, it's the same fucking movie. Yeah. It hasn't changed. You've changed.
Exactly.
And I don't see why people don't recognize that as... I see that so fucking clearly, it's aggravating to me. I'm sure that out of my 458...
And I will fully admit, I used to be in the...
You were, and I wanted to kill you.
Oh, you know, I don't like this about this. There, you know, I look back now, and I think I've mellowed.
You have.
There are things about the special edition that I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't have done that, but whatever. I still like the movies.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I own all of them. I own all of them on DVD and Blu-ray. I love
a Star Wars shelf, and it's totally unintentional. It didn't just happen that way.
It did, and it's a great set of movies.
Uh-huh.
say what you will about the man makes some iconic, fun movies.
Yeah, I mean, he's been my Facebook friend forever, but, you know, he's my Facebook friend in the way that Will Smith is my Facebook friend. Yeah. Like, you know, every couple of months, there's a...
send you actual messages.
You know, he's not like, hey, Aaron, what's going on in Confessions? No, nothing like that. But I said him...
if he was, I'd say, what the fuck, why isn't he on the show?
Yeah. Yeah, didn't you know that? We're tight.
Tight.
We're tight, yo. But no, I admire George Lucas, and I don't admire him for the, you know, there's the people out there that are not as forgiving as I am, that aren't as bad as the George Lucas Rape My Childhood people. You know, there's the people that are like, okay, you know, I'm not a fan of the prequels. They suck, but I do still like I still like, you know, American Graffiti or some of the Indiana Jones stuff. And, you know, what, and I'm not even there. I admire his whole body of work. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry, but the Star Wars prequels are not hands over fist better than the original trilogy. You know, I'm fucking killing myself here, but my point is the start. There was such a reaction to the original Star Wars trilogy because of the state of the movies at the time. You know, because there was nothing like that had come out.
That, and we've all grown up with them.
Yeah, we've grown up with them. And my nieces and nephews fucking love the Clone Wars cartoons.
Yeah.
Like Rachel's nephew Cameron loves Anakin Skywalker. Loves Anakin Skywalker.
And by that merit, I think they completely do what they set out to do.
Yeah, and they entertain kids. You know? And, you know, it's just, this is just something, it irritated me to no end, because we're going to lose a great filmmaker because people fucking suck. And I don't see why, I don't see how they got here. Is they just want to be contrarian?
No, it's
why?
Internet anonymity, and they feel that they want to bitch and moan about something, and there they go.
I don't get, and I like Indiana Jones 4, and in that, that quote that I stole from you, because I threw that up on my Facebook as soon as I read it, because I loved it so much. In that same article, and I ended up following some links, and we're getting way the fuck out of actual news, but, he says, Lucas, the feature, it's an article in the thing, the feature goes on, to have, the feature goes on to have Lucas take credit for the nuked fridge scene in Indiana Jones and the King of the Crystal Skull, noting that Steven Spielberg was trying to protect him by taking the heat for that in a recent interview. Mm-hmm. I mean, how fucking cool is that?
Well, and he also talked about how he went and did some research about it, and because Spielberg was worried about it before they filmed it, he said, as long as he doesn't break his neck... if he didn't break his neck while he's in there, he could theoretically survive this.
Yeah,
and I look at it, go, it's a frickin' pulp movie. Who cares? Willing suspension of disbelief. Don't get hung up on it. Move on and enjoy the movie.
It didn't come from nowhere, though. That was a thing. It was a urban legend that it, you know, in time of a, you know, in time of a nuclear attack, you know, in the time of the Cold War and shit, if you can't get to a bomb shelter, you know, make sure that you spend good money in your refrigerator and have it lead lined, and you could potentially live through a, you know, a nuclear explosion. Now, chances are you would probably break your fucking neck and, you know,
suffocate.
You know, I mean, and but it's an Indiana Jones
in the area of duck and cover.
Yeah, I mean, for the love of Christ, you know, you got, you know, spaceships, and you got God coming out of a box and melting Nazis. I mean, this isn't a documentary.
No.
It's a fun movie, and that's a fun scene. And
why is it such a stretch?
I don't know. I don't get it. I don't see why people are like, you know, what? Fucking UFOs? Fuck that. I'm like, did you see the other ones? Magic and God and melting Nazis and...
you know, ancient knight standing guard in front of the Grail for centuries.
I don't get it. It's just because people suck, I guess. I mean, people just want to be contrarian, and they want to not like the popular thing. And
yeah.
I'm okay. I mean, and you know what? Maybe we're standing contrarian. Maybe. You know, maybe we're inside our little bubble. But
we have a podcast.
Podcast. And I'm not being anonymous. You know, Aaron at redphonezone.com. Email me. Tell me. I suck.
Aaron at Confessions of a Movie Snob.com.
Oh, really? Aaron at I didn't know that existed. Aaron at Confessions of a Movie Snob.com.
Ethan at Confessions of a Movie.
Tell me I'm wrong. I don't care. But yeah, you know, I like having I like having that soapbox because I admire George Lucas. I mean, some of his films are not as good as the other films, but name me a filmmaker that isn't true about.
Exactly. All right.
What else has happened?
I have a feeling. I have a premonition about this episode.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to talk Hitchcock at some point.
Probably will.
But A&E is developing a Psycho prequel. It's in early development on two potential new series with a series called Bates Motel.
I remember that.
The other one is one called Those Who Kill.
Mm-hmm.
That's something else. But Bates Motel
is
Universal Television. was announced today that, from their press release, that Bates Motel serves as a prequel to the most famous fright film of all time, Psycho. A&E is currently in script development. Bates Motel will give viewers an intimate understanding of how Norman Bates' psyche developed from his childhood through his teen years. Fans will have access to the dark, twisted backstory and learn firsthand how his mother Norma and her lover, Norma.
Has that been pre-established? I'm sure.
No,
I'd never heard that before.
And her lover, Damage Norman, helping forge the most well-known serial killing motel owner in history. This really strikes me as A&E wants to replicate Dexter.
Yeah. I can see it. I can see it going either way. It could be cool.
A&E though. You know, it kind of worries me about A&E is like the poor man's AMC.
So, yeah.
If AMC was doing it, I'd be like, okay, I'm interested.
I'll check that out. I'll see.
This is from the people who brought us The Beast.
Yeah. I like The Beast. No, I didn't.
Not that Beast.
Hey, speaking of AMC, Walking Dead news.
Yeah, Walking Dead got renewed for a third season.
And?
Like 17 episodes?
16. 16? 16. Yeah. Season 2 is 12 episodes, and they're extending it by 4, making it 16.
We're only getting 3 more episodes, or wait, Seth,
12.
We got 7, right?
We got 6.
No, we got 7.
Well, then we're
so
only
we're getting another 6 episodes.
We're getting another 6 episodes, yeah. Nice. And should be cool.
It's a good show.
Yeah, it is a good show. I'm interested to see this third. I said it before season 2 that I'm really looking forward to season 3,
yeah.
In so much as I'm curious what the absence of Frank Darabont's going to do. You know,
speaking of which, did you see the interview with him with Darabont?
Where he's talking about the opener with
the opener?
That would have been
a really cool opener.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen that.
For our listeners who don't know, Frank Darabont was the showrunner for the first season. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who wrote and directed, you know, Shawshank Redemption, The Green Mile.
Hearts of Atlantis. Yes. Lots of shit on Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. I see his name popping up all the time, yeah.
Originally, if you've seen the original show, if you've seen the show, there's a part where what's the main character's name? I'm drawing a blank.
And what? Rick.
Rick, thank you.
Rick Grimes.
Where Rick is holds up in a tank in Atlanta, and there's a dead soldier there that's a zombie, and he has to shoot him. Well, I don't remember the actor's name.
Yeah, but he's somebody that we know.
Yes, he's someone we know. Well,
I'll find him.
He was Doomsday on Smallville.
Yeah.
He's also in the American version of Being Human.
Mm-hmm. I love the British Being Human. I don't know if you've seen that. It's a good
Being
fucking
Human? I love that
That's
show.
A great, the British version is so good.
I'm looking forward to season 4, believe me.
The main dude is in season 2, episode 2 of Sherlock. The Hounds of Baskerville, that actor.
Oh, the werewolf guy?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, sorry.
I look forward to seeing that. He's actually leaving Being Human after 4 seasons.
Aw.
Yes. Yes. Anyway,
but that
back
guy.
To this. but the original opener plan for season 2 was actually going to be a flashback following that soldier and how he ended up in the tank.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to show sort of brief cameos with some of the other characters that we know from the first season and how they met, but it was going to explain how he ended up there. And apparently Darabont had planned to do a lot more flashbacks and vignettes like that. So it sounded really cool, but apparently got axed because it would have cost too much, and which is unfortunate. You know, we get a cool. I would like to see it like as a
Sam Witwer.
Sam Witwer. I would like to see it as a
webisode.
A webisode.
Did you see the Bicycle Girl one?
Something like that. Get Robert Kirkman to come in and get whoever does the art for Walking Dead.
Yeah.
The comic and do a tie-in thing would be great. Like a web comic would be nice.
Yeah. Did you see the Bicycle Girl webisodes?
No.
It's pretty good.
That's the first zombie you've seen.
Yeah. The torso zombie.
Yeah.
That she's also called this.
About it,
I think it's 4 or 5 episodes. It's cool. Nice. It's heartbreaking, but, you know, well, I mean, in the way that...
Well, speaking of heartbreaking, trying to get segues in here.
Yay.
There's a Green Arrow TV series that's under development now.
Sweet.
Green Arrow television series is being planned for the CW with Greg Berlanti, Mark Guggenheim, and Andrew Kreisberg writing and executive producing, EW reports.
So it's going to be that same fucker from Smallville, right?
No. Justin Hartley previously played a television version of the character on Smallville, becoming a regular cast member in later seasons. It's not mentioned whether or not the new series would connect in any way to Smallville, but it's noted that Hartley is not being sought to play the role this time.
They're going to get somebody good?
This time. Green Arrow isn't the only DC superhero being planned for the small screen. Now, they mentioned someone here that I hadn't heard. Obviously, plans for Booster Gold Pilot were announced late last year with Blue Beetle, Dead Man, and Spectre. Series still being developed in various stages of development.
The Dead Man was one I was really interested in until I found out it was CW.
No. Well, all of these are CW. And sort of on this is Linkara did a guest spot on another video podcast where they reviewed the Wonder Woman pilot.
Yeah.
Have you watched
It's that? Horrible.
Oh, my God.
I haven't seen the Linkara one. I saw the Wonder Woman pilot.
I don't need to because this shows... Oh, my God.
I need to point out
that... Who the fuck was snorting coke off the back of a Thai prostitute and got that made?
I'd like to point out that it's very well documented, recorded, up for posterity, that I was against that from day fucking one. And then as it came out, I got more and more horrified.
I had no fucking idea how... Wow.
It's like Catwoman times 10 bad. It's horrible.
I mean, anyone who is even tangential, and I don't know a lot about Wonder Woman, okay? I would classify myself in this, I am tangentially aware of who Wonder Woman is and what she is in the comics.
Yeah.
I mean, I probably know her more from the Linda Carter freaking TV series.
I like that show.
You know, which was more faithful than this adaptation.
Yeah.
Oh my fucking God. It is just, words do not express how mind-bogglingly bad that was.
Yeah,
it did not get picked up for a reason. It was awful.
Because it sucked. It just seemed, you just kind of got to say, like, what the fuck?
I mean, saying that all of these are quote-unquote in development, we probably won't see, there are, what, five here. We'll probably not see four of these ever come to light.
Probably five at this.
Yeah, maybe even five.
I mean, how many superhero TV shows have done well?
They also don't mention Raven. They have that series Raven that's in development. And, you know, they just need to figure it out, I guess.
Green Arrow could be cool.
Yeah. Let's see. The next bit of news I got is Tim Burton talked a bit about Beetlejuice 2, but he didn't mention anything about him going Hawaiian. MTV News confirmed that Tim Burton is definitely participating in Beetlejuice 2 in some capacity. He responded Burton when asked if he was involved with the project. I love that character, and Michael is so great in it. I always think about how great and fun that character was, so I just said to Seth Graham Smith, if you have some idea about it, go for it, and then I'll look at it freshly. In the past, I tried some things, but that was the way back then. He seemed really excited about it.
Good. I hope it comes out. I hope it's fucking awesome. But Tim Burton hasn't made a good movie in over a decade, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah.
He's made Tim Burton movies.
Yeah.
You know, like Alice in Wonderland, the most Tim Burton movie of all time.
And let's do our obligatory report on, of course, Bane's voice in The Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, there's more, huh?
Christopher Nolan and his co-writer brother, Jonathan Nolan, have said, and I quote, "You have nothing to worry about."
Good.
That's the news there.
All right, good. I'm glad. I was worried about that.
I know.
Actually,
that
I don't care.
Essentially the gist of this article. It's like two paragraphs. I'm like, so the news is that...
There's nothing to worry about. That
they are saying, oh, fucking get over yourselves, people.
Yeah, it's a movie.
Oh, gosh. We have talked a bit about... obviously, we're talking reboots today. We have... Fox is still moving forward with a Fantastic Four reboot. They're moving toward Josh Trank as director for its reboot of Fantastic Four.
Josh Trank?
Yes.
Who's that?
Frank, they misspelled it. It's Josh Trank. It's either Josh Trank or Josh Frank, however they want to.
T-R-A-N-K?
Trank comes in here twice, so I think it should be Trank. Trank is the director of the upcoming movie Chronicle, in which teens who gain superpowers are attracted to their darker sides, which to me sounds like Misfits the movie. The fate of that film, which opens in a few weeks, may determine whether Fox pulls the trigger with Trank. Writer Michael Green is working on a new draft of the script, and producer Akiva Goldsman, who was
Academy Award winner,
is no longer attached to the project.
Oh.
So
that blows.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the Fantastic Four in previous episodes, how big a fan I am, and how awesome Michael Chiklis was. But, you know,
it's about it.
We'll see what happens with this.
I hope it's really cool.
I want it to be awesome. It'll pay off for the fans, you know?
Yeah, Josh Trank's filmography, at this point, his director filmography consists of five episodes of the 2007 series The Kill Point and this Chronicle that you're speaking of that I have no clue what it is.
Yeah, he's a newbie.
Yep, cool. Well,
And the two little brief bits. I know Thor turned up on your list of top movies of the year, and it was definitely one of my favorites. Idris Elba has confirmed that he will be back for Thor 2 to play Heimdall. So,
yeah, Golden Globe winner, Idris Elba.
What did he win for?
I don't remember. Something this weekend.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where the news came from. It was I actually saw it on the red carpet. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, I'll be back. I'm fucking Heimdall, motherfucker!
Yeah, yeah. So he'll be back for Thor 2. Also in the article, he said he hadn't talked to the new director or anything like that, so he doesn't know specifically, but he knows he's in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be nice. I'm excited to see the next Thor, because I liked the first one.
I liked it a lot. Such a good movie.
And the last bit of news I have shouldn't be news to anyone at all. I was lamenting with my mother the other day that, as of this year, Jurassic Park is 19 years old.
Holy crap.
It came out in 1993.
Wow.
Steven Spielberg recently said in an interview that they are developing a Jurassic Park 4, but...
Luther.
Mm. Okay. Steven Spielberg said that he's developing it, but he will not be directing it. And this article was very saddened by that, and I'm like, are you surprised that he doesn't want to direct another Jurassic Park movie? I mean, he did do the first two, and the second one was pretty goddamn awful.
Mm.
And then the third one was just boring.
It was not good. Somebody told me, it's not that bad, and I watched. I'm like, that was that bad. I mean, I like William H. Macy was in it.
So was Pete Postlewaite.
Yep.
But
I liked him. I liked him in that movie, too.
I like him in most movies that I saw him in. But Steven Spielberg has surprisingly, i.e. not surprisingly, said he's not going to direct Jurassic Park 4.
Well, poor guy.
Yeah. And apparently,
he's going to produce it and shit, right?
Yeah, he's going to be a producer on it. And they're apparently working on a script, all that craziness. They are working on the next Tintin that's going to be directed by Peter Jackson.
Yes.
And he also said in it, I know that Edgar Wright is attached.
For the third one.
For the third one, but he said that Spielberg said in an interview that Spielberg, referring to himself, would like to direct the third one. So I guess Edgar Wright is not official, not like signed for it or what. But,
well, we'll see what happens.
Edgar Wright's getting good work as a script doctor right now, so...
Which is good, but
I'd
rather see him as a director because I liked everything he's directed.
Pretty much, yeah.
So that's cool.
But that's all I got.
What about Gene Hackman?
Oh, yes, Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman, who turns, I think it's 82
just 80, isn't it?
He's an old motherfucker.
A lot fucking older than us.
Old, tough bastard got hit by a bus.
Uh-huh. And I got a text from Ethan that says, hey, Gene Hackman got hit by a bus. And what was my response?
Is the bus okay? And really, if you're thinking Gene Hackman, he's a tough old bastard. Mm. And I would be like, I would expect him to get up and punch the bus.
Yeah. I mean, that was
it. Bus?
And I kind of was like, ooh, man, that was really in poor taste. Because you'd be like, no, he's fucking dead, asshole. But I'm just like, that was just my reaction is.
He's apparently fine, you know, bumps and fucking that. But he's Gene fucking Hackman.
What's that stupid fucking website?
I guess not officially Gene fucking Hackman.
He will be, damn it. The Paris guy, Perez Hilton, his website.
Mm-hmm.
Those motherfuckers released a thing saying he was like on death's door and stuff, and his agent came out. It's like he's fucking leaving today. He was riding a bike and got hit by a bus, and it was just like, fuck yeah! I mean, that's one more notch to the Ruthos nomination that will eventually happen, I'm sure.
That the dude got hit by a bus.
He got hit by a bus. I mean, that was my big news.
Uh-huh.
The only other news, I don't even know if you're gonna call it news, but like we keep saying is today's the 18th. Sunday, so 3 days ago, was the Golden Globes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that Ethan typically watches, and I watch it. I sometimes do, sometimes don't. I like watching it.
I should one year. I just don't ever have the desire to.
My problem with it is I don't give a fuck about TV, and it's like half TV. So,
yeah.
I'm
much more into the Oscars, obviously.
Yeah. That's going to be cool. But some surprises, sort of. I mean, surprises leading up to it, retrospectively not. I mean, like the Artist. I want to talk about The Artist in a second. The Artist was a pretty big winner. I know it took actor and a drama performance. It took picture. It did not take director. That actually went to Martin Scorsese, who thanked Christopher fucking Lee in his speech, and it was awesome.
Nice.
And it took a bunch of shit like that. And I follow IMDb on my Facebook, and like every time somebody won, there would be a little thing that would pop up, and it says, so and so wins, for whatever, and something popped up for the artist, and some dumbass said, this is 2011. Why in the hell are we awarding a silent black and white film when technology can do so much more? And my question to you, Ethan, is am I really that much of a film snob to where that is just a fundamentally retarded question?
No.
I mean, what? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. I mean, that's the way I see it. And it's really fucking novel. Where is it just too... 2 years ago at the Golden Globes, at least, Avatar took Best Picture. Mm-hmm. And, that's like the cutting edge of technology. And to me, it's kind of cool that the same body of people chose to award, this film, obviously very bare bones. It's silent. It's black and white. I mean, it's a story about a Chaplin-esque, dude. But the big picture went to The Descendants, the Alexander Payne movie. And Alexander Payne, he's an okay director. I like Sideways. I think he directed that. And,
seen it.
Yeah, it's not an Ethan movie at all. But, I think that, like, the artist, we often talk about Ethan movies. The artist looks like an Aaron movie, if there ever was one. I mean,
Are you going to try to get out and see it?
I'm going to try, but it's really far away, and the tickets are expensive.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens there.
Well, but it is playing.
Yeah, it is playing. What was weird is I looked it up. The closest place I could find it was Chicago, and then Ethan looked it up, and he's like, you dumbass. It's like, and this is in Kansas City, not too far away from here. I know that George Clooney took Best Actor in a Dramatic Performance for The Descendants. I don't remember the name of the dude from The Artist, but he took whatchamacallit?
Supporting actor or actor in a comedy?
Actor in a comedy. Supporting actor, and I was very pleased with supporting actor, even though...
Peter Dinklage.
No, well, that was for a drama television show. Okay. For the film, it went to Christopher Plummer. I don't remember the name of his movie,
yes.
But Christopher fucking... I hope he wins an Oscar for it, because I love Christopher Plummer. He's fucking awesome. And then,
He's been nominated, but I don't think he's never won.
No, he's been nominated a few times. Yeah. I do remember he was nominated not too long ago for some movie where he played like an old school Hasidic Jew with like the long...
I believe he was General Kale in Star Trek VI.
Was he?
Yeah.
Huh. Peter Dinklage won.
Star Trek VI is probably the only one you'd like if you haven't seen it.
Which one's that?
It's The Undiscovered Country.
What happens in it?
It's...
Wait a minute. No. I've seen it. I've seen all of the Star Trek movies. Okay.
It's the one with the Klingon bird of prey that can firewall cloaked.
Yeah, that was okay. That was all right. It was all right.
And he's the one who's always quoting Shakespeare, and he's the bad guy at the end.
Sure in the fuck was. Hey, he's also in Sound of Music and lots of stuff. Good fucking actor. I don't remember her name, but the... but she was pretty much the lead, and I don't quite understand it, but the girl from the Help won supporting actress. And do bear in mind, people, that I am I'm not that dumb to where I'm reading this off and I don't know that. I mean, I'm obviously going off the top of my head here. She won for The Help, and she gave a nice impassioned speech the day before Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and it was nice. I don't remember a lot going on, but I do know Peter Dinklage won, and that was cool because I don't know.
Have you watched?
Last Thursday, I was editing the show, and Rachel said, fuck you, Aaron, I'm watching Game of Thrones without you. And so it was on in the background, and I wasn't really paying attention to it, but I did notice that every time he was on the screen, he got my attention.
Mm-hmm.
He's really good.
He won an Emmy for it last year.
He won an Emmy for it, Golden Globes. I mean, he's getting all kinds of accolades for it. And, if they figured out a way...
Really good.
If they played this shit in the theater for a week, and it got Oscar consideration, they would be tripping over themselves to give themselves an Oscar for it, because I'm nothing but
it's a great character. I've read the books, and
you had George R.R. Martin on your other podcast, right?
Yeah, so
that's pretty sweet. But I was captivated by him for what I saw, and I wasn't paying attention to the show at all, but Rachel's fucking loving it, so that's a good thing. What else do we have? But, you know, Golden Globes happened. The Oscar nominations are coming up this Tuesday. Should be cool. And it should be cool. I'm sure we'll be talking about that on the show at some point.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But what you been watching? Anything good?
What have I been watching?
Yeah, we've been doing the last couple of shows, and I kind of like it, so we're going to keep doing it.
What I've been watching?
Both of us. It just kind of happened.
Yeah, you were on a Next Gen kick for a short while. Now you're on a Young Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
I watched the first technically four episodes of it.
So the first two.
I've really been enjoying it, but I've sort of gotten sucked into playing Oblivion on Xbox 360.
Oblivion.
I actually got a new Xbox 360. So.
Oh, you got a new one, did you?
Yes, it's one of the black ones with built-in Wi-Fi. It's very nice.
Shiny.
Other than that, I've been catching up on Bones. Watching some movies that I've been meaning to watch again or
anything good?
Catch up on. So, I've been... I'm in a documentary film class this semester, and I watched Exit Through the Gift Shop last week.
Yeah, the Banksy film. Yeah.
I watched a couple extra documentaries.
Did you watch Restapro?
No.
Last I checked, it was on Netflix, and it was supposed to win last year. It just didn't for some weird reason. It wasn't that great.
So I watched a few documentaries here and there. The best worst movie about Troll 2 and...
I don't see how you can...
None of them that just, you know, stood out to me. It's like, this is all with the captains. I watched that documentary.
Is that any good?
Yeah, if you don't like Star Trek, you wouldn't like it.
Trekkies is terrifying to me. It's one of the scariest
I never
ducks.
Saw that one. So.
You never saw Trekkies? It's fucking terrifying.
Other than...
You saw War Horse.
Yeah, I did see War Horse, which was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Just okay. I'm tempted to do a review of it. I don't really think that
you don't care enough.
It was okay, but it's, you know, it's Steven Spielberg being okay.
Yeah,
which Steven Spielberg being okay is better than most directors out there.
Mm-hmm.
It follows the horse around, and in doing that, you sort of lose any human connection in the movie, and you sort of feel more for the horse than you do anything else. And when the horse's friend dies, there's really like no real emotion.
And like I said, it's called War Horse, not War Human. So no, I mean, I get it.
I get it too, but there's no real emotion in it.
Sure.
I mean, there are some great scenes. It's filmed beautifully.
Scene transitions.
Great scene transitions. it's okay.
Yep.
Spielberg has done much
sure.
better.
That's something that I never anticipated going to the theater.
I bet it will be nominated for Best Picture, but I
kind of have my doubts.
I just don't think it's not Best Picture material.
If it's nominated for Best Picture, Spielberg will not be nominated.
Probably get cinematography.
Sure.
Beautiful.
Was that Janosch?
I think so.
Yeah, probably. I mean, he's got a billion fucking... Well, three or four, probably.
Yeah,
Janosch right. Kaczynski or whatever his name is. I don't remember when I gave up on Star Trek, but when I realized I was liking about one episode a season, I'm like, this isn't worth it. I mean, I'm not saying it's bad, but...
You should try to push on at some point and watch the rest.
Maybe, but...
It gets better.
See, and then after that, I think is when I discovered. I think it was when I got into a pissing contest with the Magna Board Boys, and they're saying how much King of the Crystal Skull sucked. And I went to go try to find it, and I realized that Young Indie Chronicles were on
and both
Netflix.
Unified our fronts, and you said that I had to step up and defend it.
You're damn right. That movie
so
kicks ass.
I think
ass.
I have stepped up to defend that.
You
movie.
Step up and defend the fuck out of that movie. But yeah, it's
now I desperately want those movies on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Uh-huh.
But my thing about it is that was a show that I watched when I was a kid, and it's funny, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was like literally a couple of months older than the kid that played young in like 9 year old Indy, like Corey Carrier. I mean, he's like a little bit younger than me.
I remember when that show came out, and it was the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles.
Yeah,
but that's I didn't watch any of them. I was told that they weren't very good.
And
so I never watched them.
I watched them and I liked them, but I also like
four were entertaining.
I enjoy it, and I do remember when I was a kid, I preferred the kid Indy to Sean Patrick Flannery Indy,
right.
And I assumed that would go away as I got older, but no, I still prefer the kid Indy. I find it a little bit more interesting. I like the wonderment and shit that's going on, and
just being contrary again.
Yeah, sucks. But not being contrary, and I watched Sherlock series 3. I mean. You know, why are we friends with Paul? I'll tell you why we're friends with Paul. He brought up the fact that Sherlock has had aired. I had no idea.
I had heard it wasn't coming out till like April or May, but apparently that just it's not coming out.
here.
Here yeah. until April or May. I was like, oh.
So, you know, we,
okay.
you know, fight the SOPA. We found it. Yeah. And I watched all that. And
I haven't watched it yet because my mom wants to watch it.
Oh, it's so good. And I'm not going to, I mean, I teased this a little bit. It doesn't give anything away, but the Deerstalker shows up nice. And it's hilarious. Such a good show. And then other than that, I've been watching Young Indy. I watched Last Crusade on Sunday.
I'm thinking there's an indie marathon in my future.
Yeah, so. It's going to be good shit. But, I mean, other than that, got nothing. I had a long-ass Geekly happening. It's probably the longest we've ever done.
Oh, yeah.
But, hey, it'll happen. And that's what editing's for.
Yes.
But,
with that.
I guess so. It's going to blow. But, hey, that rhymed. However, stay tuned. We're going to be right back with Chris McLaughlin, and we're going to be talking about remakes / reboots. We are joined tonight with Christopher McLaughlin, McG. Say hello, sir.
Good evening.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again. We just had you
more Hitchcockian about it. You know, good evening.
Good evening. Good evening. But we're going to be doing our discussion on. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about this, Christopher? Explain this story to people about how this came to be.
I think in the midst of one of our discussions about potential shows, I think we may have actually been prepping for another topic, and right in the middle of that, I think it was going through that really long period of time where I wasn't sleeping for more than 2 hours. In the middle of preparing for another topic, I just threw out, hey, we should do remakes. Because, you know, for some reason, I think we human beings, we get this foolish notion that we need to challenge ourselves from time to time. And usually that's when we look at our absolutely most ridiculous.
Sure.
So I thought remakes was about the most challenging thing that I could possibly do. Because most of our topics, 20 to 30 films came to mind. This one came to mind. And I actually had to work to fill this list out. And I've got a list I'm happy with. You know, I'm really pleased with my choices.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly turned out far better than I would have imagined. But I was really, really glad that we had this opportunity to challenge ourselves. Now, the funniest side of that is I pitched it thinking, you know, that's going in the idea jar next to, you know, like best Bigfoot films or, you know, greatest Rob Schneider performances. And I think within 2 weeks, we're like, so we're all set for the remake show. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel. No, I actually thought it would be a lot of fun, and I wanted to challenge you, because you usually just smoke us, and I know how much you don't like.
Well, going into this list, I figured out two things. One, there are a hell of a lot of freaking remakes out there, and some movies that I had no idea were remakes, you know?
Yeah.
I found that too, but none of them made my list.
Yeah, well, I sort of attacked this list with sort of a caveat saying I had to have seen the original and seen the remake. I mean, so I could say, yes, it's a better remake than it's a good remake of this. But there are a lot out there that you could argue are remakes of something else. You know, you could argue that Forbidden Planet is a quote unquote remake of The Tempest. Although I didn't put it on the list because I'm like, let's not. I don't want to go there. I could argue the Three Musketeers movies.
Yeah.
I mean, how many freaking times has that been made?
Gosh, mm-hmm.
Public domain.
Like we said last week, you can argue Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, you could that.
I mean, there's all kinds of them, and
there are a lot of there are good ones. There are a lot of there's sort of a lot of good ones, a lot of bad ones. But I think one side I was looking around researching those quote-unquote remakes or reboots had 600 or 700 movies listed. So, I mean, there's a lot of these damn things, and there's a ton out there, too. And that's not including sequels. You know,
right.
If you include sequels, we're in the thousands upon thousands of movies. I mean, this was an interesting list to sort of sit down and do.
I'm not going to say I had fun making this list, because I mean, I had about as much fun as I had making this list as I do any list, but I actually decided to approach it differently, you know, because, you know, we've been doing this for umpteen million shows now. I think we're 70 or 80, I don't know. But anyway,
we have to know when we do our 100th episode.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
So we can do something special for that.
Our top top 10 movies with 100 in the title.
Yes.
No, but I decided that, you know, I've done
this. We'll have our favorite cast, McGee, back on.
There you go.
Thank you.
My thought about this was I didn't want to do another list like every single list that I've done, because remakes is a different sort of beast than, you know, a noir or a comedy or whatever.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's obviously, you know, you have all your content of the movie, which is fine, but, you know, there also needs to be more going on there. And so I decided I'm gonna you know, try to pull a McGee, and I was gonna like have all my caveats in my, you know, and my, you know, the why I would include it in my list and whatnot. And one thing that I did find out was I started looking at this, and we are sitting in it right now. It's January 18th, 2012, and you ask any Nimrod on a message board, you know, what's the worst thing going on in Hollywood right now? And the first thing anybody's going to say is all the damn sequels and reboots and remakes and stuff like that.
It's been the story for 20 years.
Which has been the story since the original remake, the first ever film remake. It was in 1904. It was a remake of the 1903 Great Train Robbery. So this is nothing new. It's nothing new at all. And so
one thing Hollywood, even back then, it wasn't really Hollywood. It's the film industry is all about is imitation and rehashing, and especially in those early days.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, Great Train Robbery wasn't much to that. So.
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing is like, you know, but it was a huge success.
Yeah,
I mean, it was an absolutely huge, huge, huge success, and so they're all like, oh, fuck, let's milk that a little bit more, and you know, by all accounts, the 1904 version is
the film industry is really happy to milk things a lot, often to the point after it's dead.
Oh, sure.
See the Highlander franchise.
Yeah. and working out my caveats, you know, I started thinking about, you know, like, I said, okay, what do I need to look for? And the first thing, you know, my first gut reaction was that, you know, okay, I want to do only remakes that I feel needed to be made. And then the more I thought about it, you know, the more I realized that that's really giving too much credit to, you know, to filmmakers, to filmgoers, to people like you and me and everybody, you know, mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, no, we don't need a remake of Police Academy, but we didn't need Police Academy to begin with.
We really didn't need a remake of Footloose.
We don't need it. We don't need Citizen Kane.
We really don't need a remake of Red Dawn, for Christ's sake.
We don't need movies. It's just nice to have.
That's true.
And so what I ended up having to do was, you know, I ended up, you know, just scrapping that list I'd already started. And then I said, you know, I'm just going to look at what it taught us, you know, what it added to the movie industry, to things like that. And I came up with an interesting list, and I definitely going to have some on here that's going to raise some serious eyebrows.
Yeah, and I arranged my list according to stuff I actually would really like to talk about this time. So.
And, you know, I kind of did that too. And why don't we get into this, because, you know, we have more to say. We have a lot to say about this, I feel. Do you have anything to add before we, you know, just take a bite out of it, Christopher?
No, sir. I couldn't top that wonderful rant of yours.
Sorry. Sorry about that. But, you know.
No, quite all right.
It's what we do well.
You just have me curious about your list now.
Well, I mean.
Here we are on the reboot of Red Phone Zone.
Yeah. This is Red Phone Zone Episode 1. It's a reboot. It's a remake.
Yes, we're remaking the show.
And I want to point something out. You said you're interested about my list. When we did our comedy show, you said something along the lines of, oh, Captain Obvious strikes again. And I think you're being way too, you know, cruel to yourself, because if you're Captain Obvious, Ethan and I are, you know, president and vice president of obviousness in this world. And this list is going to very much show that, because these are very obvious remakes. But I've actually given some thought to it, so we'll see what happens. And with that, Ethan, what's your number six? I'm dying to hear it.
All right. Well, getting into my list, my number six, again, movies I want to talk about. My number six, sort of more mainstream, is the 2010 remake of The Karate Kid, directed by Harold Zwart.
That's my number eight.
I went into this movie seeing the original. It's a remake of
1984.
For John G. Avildsen.
Academy Award winner John G. Avildsen.
For The Karate Kid. And I went into this movie going, they're doing another freaking remake. So I didn't see it in theaters until enough people said, you know, it's actually not too bad. And I think what brings out a good remake, this one does well in that it has some respect for the original. It doesn't, it's not making fun of it. It might poke fun here and there at it, because there's that scene with the fly swatter and
sure.
That's a little nod to the original fans.
It's a good natured jest,
but it's not, you know, oh well, the original was stupid, so mm-hmm. we're going to do a remake. But this one went in its own direction instead of It decided to do the same story at its core. It's the same same story, but it decided to really change things up and, you know, put in a kid who can actually act and have a different story to it in that, or a different, not really story. It's have a different elements to it in that it's in China. And some new sort of updated material to it, which made it real nice instead of just a flat-out remake. Because they could have just done it as a, you know, a flat-out, I'm a karate, you know, I'm moving from New Jersey to California and doing that whole business again and had it starting to...
They kept enough of the original to keep people interested, but they changed it up enough to where you would pay attention.
Yeah, and a lot of people were upset, you know, it's like, why are they calling it the Karate Kid? It's, you know, it's the Kung Fu Kid. And it's like, well, you're missing the point.
Mm-hmm. This is in spirit of the original Karate Kid.
And really, the things that get me as far as good remakes or good quote-unquote reboots is reverence for the original material.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you're remaking this for a reason. It's because at some level, whether you want to admit it or not, you liked the original.
Sure.
And that it did something right, so you want to do it again.
And I picked this as my number 8. When we get up to like the 8, 9, 10s of my list, those are mostly movies that fall in the remakes that I liked category. I don't really think that this added a whole lot to, you know, movies in general. But I did enjoy this one. I did a review for the site when it came out. And one thing I pointed out then, and I'm going to say it again, is I really, really, really dug Jackie Chan. I thought it was one of his better, at least American performances he's ever done.
I mean, I went on a big Jackie Chan kick years and years and years and years ago. Back when, I think it was when Big Trouble, or not Big Trouble, Rumble in the Bronx came.
Yeah.
I went on a mission and found a bunch of his movies, and a lot of people who look at Jackie Chan nowadays don't really realize how really a good a dramatic actor the guy is.
And he is.
It was nice to see him sort of flex his muscles in that one.
Yeah, it was good. Now, is this one that you bothered seeing, Christopher?
I saw enough clips of it, and just the very genesis of it was enough to turn me off on it, because I sort of vacillate on what the worst television show ever was, but I went through a long period of time when it was my Super Sweet 16.
Okay.
And this kind of struck me as like the feature length episode of my Super Sweet 16. Look, my dad got me a Blockbuster and paid Jackie Chan to come to my party. And, you know, I mean, okay, and okay, admittedly, if you're going to remake The Karate Kid, it's not like you're remaking something off the AFI 100 list.
Right. Or...
You know, the original Karate Kid is essentially teen Rocky. And,
right.
You know, there's already, like, a couple of more Rocky films than we need, and there's certainly about four more from the original Karate Kid series than we need. So it's a remake of a movie that's already had too many sequels that really had trouble justifying its existence in the first place. So,
mm-hmm. I felt with this one is they did a good job of updating it for a modern kid audience, for a modern, I guess, preteens or teenage audience. So I felt that it still had a good relevance, and like I said, it's the reverence to the original material that really gets me.
Yeah, and I like this movie. I mean, I was actually kind of running out of movies that I really particularly cared about when I was, you know, looking at a list of this. I threw it on here. I like it. You know, my thing about it is, you know, when you say a movie that, you know, I don't think we needed the original Karate Kid, so we certainly didn't need, you know, 2, 3, 4, the next, and the original. But, you know, it does have its audience, and I do think that when they're sticking movies into the movie mill and, you know, pumping out movies, at least, you know, this one came out with, you know, some definite highlights in it, and, you know, that's fine by me. It's what it is, and I don't expect it to change the world, and I don't expect it to end the world, and it didn't either. So that's why I picked it.
Well, okay, I will agree with you that it wasn't on the level of, say, remaking Psycho.
Right.
Just something that's just an affront to every art.
Spoiler warning, the remake of Psycho is not on my list.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
it's not. You know, if you're remaking Karate Kid, at best, it's pointless. It isn't cultural sacrilege like a lot many other remakes are. So I'll say that for it.
Okay. Now you were kind enough to let me go on a rant at the beginning of this, and do you need to go on any rant before you get into your list here?
No, I'm good.
Okay. What's your number 6?
Number 6, one that I think that will delight the house here. I had to go with the 2004 Coen Brothers remake of The Lady Killers.
You know, that didn't make my list, and I am surprised.
The only reason that didn't make my list is because I've never seen the original.
I actually just forgot about it.
But my love of that movie, The Lady Killers, is well known, documented. It is a fantastic movie.
And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it can take the place of The Karate Kid. I'd just forgotten about it. So, but whatever.
I specifically took it off because I hadn't seen the original one.
Right.
So, I mean... Yeah, I didn't want to make any judgments there.
Sure. And this is something that, you had that caveat on your list, and I didn't, but I have seen every one of these originals, so that's cool. Sure. Now what is it about it that you like? Other than, are you just trying to please us, or did you genuinely like stuff about it?
I genuinely love many things about it. As I said during Coen Brothers show, I love the wonderful moral universe that it inhabits. I love its celebration of black gospel music and the fact that it's genuinely funny. But here's the thing: in this context of remakes, here's what I love about the Lady Killers remake. This list sort of forced me to think about, well, what is it that can actually go into making a good remake? And first of all, one of the key ingredients seems to be you have to have an extraordinarily skilled filmmaker involved.
Check.
Even they don't pull it off this time. There are a lot of really top-notch filmmakers who've tried remakes and given birth to a whole lot of meh.
Oh, yeah.
But... I think one of the ingredients
we were just talking the Psycho remake. Gus Van Sant, he's a talented filmmaker.
Yes, he is.
Yes. Oh, yes. And the other thing is, if you can take a foreign film and make what's great about that film relevant to a different culture, because they're both films are wonderfully quirky and funny and tour de force for great actors like Tom Hanks and Alec Guinness. But whereas, the original is all Ealing British quirk, it's so much so that it's almost incomprehensible to you unless you're something of an Anglophile.
Yeah.
But they're able to be quirky in a completely different, distinctly Southern American way in the remake. So, to me, I don't look at the original and see that it screamed out to be remade, but they were able to replace the Britishness of it with something unique and worthwhile in and of itself. And that, I think, makes it one of the better remakes ever done.
It's a great movie. I
do really like it. If I remember, I ranked really high on my Coen Brothers list.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. It's rightfully so. It's a good movie.
It's a real good movie.
It's one that it's one of those movies that, one, not a lot of people know it's a remake. And two, not a lot of people know about it. I don't think it did very well at theaters.
It didn't.
No.
And it's sort of that one of those movies that slipped under the radar. It's like going, oh, whoa, that's a Coen Brothers movie? Wow, okay, huh. When did that come out? Really? Huh.
Yeah.
So
it's one that like I said on the show, actually, this is kind of irrelevant. I was just going to talk about how, I didn't know it was a Coen Brothers movie when I watched it and then realized it over the course of it, and only to have it, verified, at credits, but cool. Okay, now my number six. I need to throw it in there that I said at the beginning of this that I built this list off of films that I wanted to look at. What they actually added. Excuse me, to the movie genre, and I also want to point out, and this is a major caveat, I want it known that I do not enjoy this film, but I picked the 1998 Gus Van Sant Hitchcock, or Psycho. Now, bear in mind with me, guys.
I'll see you next week.
Bear in mind, guys. What I said was I wanted to look at what it gave us, to the movie genre, and I don't want to plagiarize too much. So, if you're listening to this, go check out RogerEbert.com. Check out his review of it. And he said it way better than I ever could. He's a professional writer. He's more articulate. He knows more about film. But basically, and I got the same feeling from it, is this movie is absolutely invaluable to show you that there's a lot more to a film than just pointing the camera where Hitchcock pointed the fucking camera at. Mm-hmm. That, just acting like Anthony Perkins is not going to give you the same performance as Norman Bates.
Green Goblin.
Yeah, but, what's funny about it is you look at this movie, you look at stuff like, and I haven't seen this movie since, 1998, 99, and when I look at it, there's something.
I was working in the movie theater when it came out, so I got to screen this movie.
Groovy. But what's funny about it is I remember, I remember watching the movie, I'm like, okay, Vince Vaughn sucks. Anne Hesh sucks. Viggo Mortensen sucks. Julianne Moore sucks.
I've forgotten that Viggo
was the detective dude that.
Sure.
But I remember also thinking that, William H. Macy wasn't bad. Philip Baker Hall wasn't bad. And when I was doing my research for this, what I found out is all those people I said sucked, they tried to put their own spin on the character. Norman wanted, guy that played Norman, Vince Vaughn, wanted to bring out the weirdness of him. And the thing about it is, Anthony Perkins didn't do that. Anthony Perkins was just weird, so he didn't need to work towards that. Vince Vaughn is too normal.
Try to bring the weird.
Right. It's just who he was.
It was already weird to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And Anne Hesch tried to, you know, bring up the feminism of it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And William H. Macy, Philip Baker Hall, basically said they wanted to redo exactly what they saw on the screen. So, holy shit, the two good things in the movie are the two things they tried to leave the same. I also want to, when you look at the movie, there's probably a dozen or so things that are different. The two that jump to mind, and the big one was the scene when Norman was looking at Marion when she was in the shower. In the original, he's just looking at her. It's just kind of creepy. You see you see the eye. In the remake, he's masturbating. And, you know, well, of course it was, because this is 1998 instead of 1960. Yeah. That takes a lot away from the character Norman Osborn. The son of a bitch, Norman Bates. And then, the other thing is something I've talked an awful lot about. The establishing shot in it, Hitchcock originally wanted to do it as a long establishing shot, you know, coming from one point all the way to another point. Technology wouldn't allow him to do it.
Yeah.
So he had to, you know, take a bunch of shots and cut them all together.
Right.
And the technology had caught up at that point to where Gus Van Sant was able to do what Hitchcock wanted, and it sucked.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good shot. It was long. It was tedious. It felt like art house, and it was dumb. And it's something that I often talk about is, you know, that's the problem that you're going to run into with CGI. It's the problem you're going to run into with, you know, pretty much, you know, getting, you know, whatever you really want out of a film, because sometimes there's happy accidents. Look at Jaws. Look at Psycho. Look at, you know, all this kind of stuff. It just, you know, it just adds that layer to a film that, you know, really makes it a film. And I think that I'm saying that, and I keep saying it, I'm not a fan of this film, but you cannot discount what it taught us, because Gus Van Sant is a good filmmaker. He should not try to be Hitchcock. He should try to be Gus Van Sant.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what I'm saying, is it showed us that, because in terms of a shot-for-shot remake, that's what it taught us. Now, it didn't need to be made, but I'm also saying Psycho didn't need to be made. Not a fucking movie ever needed to be made. It's, you know, It's fun. I mean, it's something that you're supposed to enjoy. But in terms of it, I thought that was a very valuable lesson that we learned there.
It is a valuable lesson to learn from that movie.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow every single note and every single you know, little piece of evidence you have. You can follow shot for shot a movie that is lauded as one of the best movies of all time, and you get a steaming, horrible, awful pile of crap.
And it's neat. It teaches you the film is in the ether. It's not in the fucking lens.
It teaches you that there's more to it than technicality.
Right. There's more to it than camera skill. I mean, it's fascinating in that respect. Never want to watch it again, but it's fascinating on an intellectual level just to talk about remakes. And luckily, how many shot-for-shot remakes have happened after that? No. Very little. I'm not going to say none, because I'm not sure of that, but very little.
Christopher, you tell me you've seen this awful movie.
I caught it back during my having every pay cable channel, and when I was wound up watching everything just out of sheer desperation at some point. And I'd probably be more angered by this film if I weren't so utterly baffled by why it exists.
Yeah.
Who thought this would be a good idea? But I will say one thing for it. Honestly, I now have something good I can say about it, thanks to you guys. I really want to see this film where it's Norman Osborn.
That'd be interesting.
I
would see that remake. Yeah.
I've already bought a ticket for that one.
Yeah, I'd see that remake. But but do you get my point? First off, I just think it's more interesting to talk about this than to just masturbate over the fact that we like the Karate Kid. I mean, it's more of an interesting conversation, and I do think it gave us that. And that's, I mean, while the product sucked, the end result's better.
It was an interesting experiment
that failed, but it's fascinating, but on that level.
Its failure, it accomplished something.
Yeah. So I'm sorry, but that's why I picked it from a number six, because I wanted to talk about it.
We all know we want a shot for shot remake of Citizen Kane.
Sure, why not?
Well, I don't want to sound like I'm crapping all over your outside the box thinking on this, because honestly, I think it's marvelous. But honestly, you know, you should have saved it. We should do like a most interesting failure show.
Well, you know what? I could do that without this, because, you know, when it comes down to it. Interesting failures is stuff like Troll 2 to me, not Psycho.
Things that fail up.
Yeah, because, you know, Psycho, I don't ever want to fucking see it again. Troll 2, I've seen it a million times hated every second of it, but I'm still compelled to watch. And, you know, that would be something that would be on a, you know, in that terms. And I just think that's an interesting thing about it. And,
yeah, and we did cheesy movies a long time ago.
Yeah, and it wasn't on there. But I don't think I'd seen it at that point.
I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's interesting. But, yeah, that's why I picked it from number six, Shoot Me. But like I said, I don't want to plagiarize too much. Check out Roger Ebert's review of it. He says it much more articulate and gets the points across much better than I ever could. So. Nice. All right, Ethan, what's your number five?
My number five is a movie I hadn't actually thought about in quite some time, but it's a 2001 film by director Barry Skolnick, starring Vinnie Jones. It's a remake of the 1974 Burt Reynolds movie The Longest Yard. It's called Mean Machine.
Yeah.
And it's got Vinnie Jones and Jason Statham and a bunch of others in it. And whereas I was not a fan of the original, nor was I a fan of the direct, you know, Longest Yard remake with
Adam Sandler and whatnot. Yeah,
this movie actually puts it in England and makes it actually European football, so it's soccer, and actually spun it off into a much more funnier, grittier movie because you got Vinnie Jones in there basically playing himself. Which is, you know, what Vinnie Jones does.
He goes,
But it had some good heart to it that I really felt that the original just lacked. So I guess it ended up on number five on my list just for sheer. I enjoyed this one. I enjoyed this version of it. I liked what they did with the characters. I liked what they did to update it. So yeah, there you have it. It's a Mean Machine.
Very good. I'm aware of the movie. I haven't seen it. I also didn't realize it was a remake. So, I'll be damned. Anything to add, Christopher?
Only that I consider the original to be one of the finest American films ever made, and I will break your fucking neck if you disagree. Joke. Reference film.
I'm just glad you're not in Kansas.
Yeah, we're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah, because you'd mop up the state with me.
Yeah, I bet.
I just sit on you or something. It'd be fine.
And I love you guys, so there's that.
Well, we love you, too. Why don't we try to get rid of some of that love, and what's your number five?
Oh, my number five. One of the other things that I learned is not only is it a good remake require a master filmmaker, but there was a time in the 20th century, and that seems even longer than it really is, when as the technology of movies was expanding, that was actually something that opened up new avenues of expression for filmmakers. I mean, even some of the stuff that didn't last, like 3D. I mean, if you've ever had the honor and privilege of seeing Dial M for Murder in 3D.
Oh, that would be so nice.
You see what that technology could have been in the hands of a filmmaker that really knew how to use it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I found out that there were a lot of films that, got better or at least worthwhile just by remaking them with color and sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with filmmakers who really knew how to use those tools. And I'm not slagging older filmmakers because they didn't know how to use tools they didn't have. Don't get me wrong. But I was amazed what a difference that made for me comparing some revisions. So in that spirit, my number five was the 1960 version of House of Usher that Roger Corman shot.
That's a fun movie.
Yes. And it's just, first of all, you have one of, not the best film Corman ever made, but certainly one of them. You have a mesmerizing Vincent Price performance, which sort of, blinds you to the fact that only really him and Barbara Steele can actually act in the film.
Sure.
Not Barbara Steele. Female lead. Oh, God, I'm blanking on female lead in it. Okay, she's the second okay actress in it. But anyway, my larger point is, and it really makes you appreciate the contributions of the people that Corman had the good taste to surround himself with. Floyd Crosby's photography, Danny Haller's art direction. And the fact that, this Richard Matheson script puts, the central, sort of incest thing out there, it's right there. I mean, it's never openly stated, but it might as well be. And to be able to handle such a salacious topic like that and keep it under wraps the way that Poe did and still have it right there for anybody who's really paying attention, that's an exercise in good taste and restraint. And oddly enough, faithfulness to the original, especially given how much Matheson had to expand it, that I just simply find to be a really outstanding film. And, he would go on to make better films in the Poe series, but not many. Not many. House of Usher, darn fine film.
Now, we are talking Myrna Fahey.
Is that correct?
Oh, thank you. Thank yeah. you. Yes. Yes. Barbara Steele is in Pit and the Pendulum.
That's right. That's right. Okay. That's one I have seen, and I don't think I've seen the original, but I did see that one. And, you know, it's good for a Roger Corman, Vincent Price movie. I mean, you don't expect much out of it, and you get more than you expect, so that's a good thing.
On a similar side note, when I was a kid growing up, one of my favorite movies to watch was the Roger Corman, The Raven.
Yep.
Oh, yes, and it still holds up.
Yeah, with Peter Lorre.
Love Peter Lorre.
Boris Karloff. Jack Nicholson. Very young Jack Nicholson.
Very young.
Yes. Yeah, and of course, Vincent Price, so... So whenever we're talking Vincent Price, that's the movie that always pops to mind when I was from my childhood. So I actually never saw the Fall of the House of Usher, the House of Usher 1960. So
yeah, it's a good one. I think it's one I saw on the shelf at Miracle Video and took it home one night. And,
it's a Richard Matheson script. It's a Roger Corman direction, and it's 80 minutes of Vincent Price. It's well worth your time.
Sure. Richard Matheson is a name that pops up a lot.
He is.
Yes.
Especially with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you bring him up quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's you.
And this is the same Richard Matheson that did I Am Legend and all those, right?
Yeah.
Well, the Night Stalker adaptation, I Am Legend, and
yeah, he's a name that I've noticed in various things that I've liked, and I mean, I just really knew him as a novelist. I had no idea he worked in film.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know you were a novelist. I just knew you worked in film until we did our was it pre-Star Wars sci-fi?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
And a tremendously nice man. One of the guys that I just could barely speak. I was in such an awe of him. But apparently he's used to people being in awe around him because he was very, very nice. And
that's good.
I've always been grateful for that.
That is good.
Apparently he's still alive.
Very good.
Yes, he is.
Very good. Because you guys are so nice to let me go on that nice long tangent about a piece of crap movie, I'm going to try to make this as short and sweet as possible because I have talked about it a lot on the show. It's the 2005 Christopher Nolan film Batman Begins. What it added to film was basically what it did is it stripped the bullshit that both Schumacher and Burton threw onto, you know, the Batman mythos and just took it down to being about story and character, and you actually wanted to see Batman as much as you wanted to see, you know, Ra's al Ghul or Scarecrow or etc. And that meant a lot to me, and I said before it's my favorite Batman movie that it's ever come out, and that's all I have to say about it because I went on way too long about Psycho, but I like it. It's my number five.
You've also talked a bit about Batman Begins in our various Batman shows.
Yeah.
And you know, Batman Begins is great. I left it off my list because I knew you were going to.
Yeah.
I was hoping you would talk about it.
I tried to stick it up in the 7 through 10 range, but I couldn't do it because I do adore everything about the movie.
No.
But yeah, when it comes down to it, that's what it gave us, is it gave us good Batman movies, not toy Batman movies. And I'm not one of those people that, you know, entirely blames that on Schumacher. You know, obviously he did, you know, bad things in the franchise. I think Burton is just as unforgivable, and that's where I am. I like the movie. Do you have anything to say about it, Christopher? I really have my doubts.
You know, to me, it was perfectly acceptable Batman. I liked the bits I liked, and just couldn't get past the. Well, I remember the night after, right after I saw it, I did a Facebook status update. I said, I'm glad they changed the working title. Dear sweet God, Katie Holmes can't act.
Yeah.
You know,
and they fixed that in the sequel. So yay.
Yes.
And then killed her.
As good as having Liam Neeson in anything, and mm-hmm. as born to be Batman as Christian Bale was, and as talented a filmmaker as Nolan is, you know, you just can't get around that giant sucking. I mean, she's the Sofia Coppola of Batman Begins.
Sure.
And I just, it's perfectly, it's a perfectly acceptable film, but just I couldn't rank it on any top lists.
And that's fine. I just, you know, my thing about it is, you know, I never thought in a million years I would get Ra's al Ghul in a movie, let alone a good movie. And yeah. I got both those things, and it was Liam Neeson, so I'm like, cool. And you know, I can look past the gaping hole that is Mrs. Tom Hanks, whatever the fuck, or Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes, her.
Mrs. Tom Hanks can act.
Mrs. Norman Osborn.
Very good. Ethan, what's your number four?
All right, Aaron, what's my favorite movie?
Seven Samurai.
Okay. My number four is the
Magnificent Seven.
Magnificent Seven.
Left that off my list because I hoped you were going to bring it up.
And this was a movie I used to hate.
Oh yeah,
this was
since I've known you.
Yes, back in, you know, when I was much more of a film snob.
Yeah,
I was like, they remade my favorite movie. It was awful. Yeah. And then I, you know, got my head out of my ass and actually sat down to watch this movie.
Yul Brynner rocks
it. It's you know, Magnificent Seven, 1960, directed by John Sturges, with. I mean, I love the cast in this movie. Yeah. Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, and James Coburn. Come the fuck on.
Yeah, that's like a...
Talk about some icons. That,
yeah, you got some Ocean's 11 shit going on there.
Yeah, and this movie has been... I mean, you could argue remakes of... I mean, there have been numerous remakes of Seven Samurai out there. And this was Bugs this Life. Was really the first actual remake of Seven Samurai. It was Magnificent Seven. I love this movie. It's a lot of fun. It's desperately needs a good version on Blu-ray. But you know, talk about creating an iconic type of a story, an iconic movie. Because you know, not everyone has heard of Seven Samurai, but more people have heard of Magnificent Seven. Especially there was a TV series, for crying out loud.
I had no idea people hadn't heard of Seven Samurai. Must be that damn bubble I live in.
Yeah, must be. but just as Kurosawa always basically pioneered the Eastern that influenced and created what we know of the Western today.
Correct.
This movie took that and solidly said, well, yeah, that movie's a perfect Western, so we're making it a Western, and so here you go. We're going to put Steve McQueen and Yul Brynner and all these great people in it, and we're going to make it a fantastic Western with some great action. You know, and they don't change much of the story. You know, it's still basically the same movie, down to I think even the same people who die, more or less,
right.
Same analog. And you know, you have just this great mashup of characters. It's that Ocean's 11. It's that ensemble where you have all these great people working together. That even in the Seven Samurai really didn't have, as far as these, you know, actors that everybody knew. It's like you had some that obviously were, hey, they were pretty cool, but the story was more important. This made it much more of a, well, a Western thing.
Yeah.
You know, you had to have those.
Certainly more fun than the Seven Samurai.
Oh, yeah.
Seven Samurai is wonderful, and it's great, but it's not very fun to watch. And, you know, Magnificent Seven's, it's fun. It's Charles Bronson being a...
I've never seen the sequel to this movie.
Return?
Seven, Return of the... Whatever.
Yeah.
I hear they're not very good.
Nah. But
this one is definitely solidly in my mind as a good remake, a fun remake. It's one that
I think it's very respectful.
Yeah, it took that original, said, okay, Seven Samurai is a great film. It has this great Western element to it. Let's make it a Western, and let's not fuck with it. It's not broken, so let's not fuck with it.
Right.
And boom. And that's what we got out of The Magnificent Seven in 1960.
That's a good movie. It's Charles Bronson being a badass, Steve McQueen being sexy, and Yul Brynner being bald. I mean, what else do you want out of a movie?
I mean, and Yul Brynner created this Western icon there, because, I mean, Westworld, you know, pretty much is playing the same guy. I mean, I'll always remember Yul Brynner from this. Not from I'll remember him from The Ten Commandments and from The King and I, but I remember him from his
anti-smoking PSA that he did that, you know, well, I mean, I obviously remember from his films, but that's one of those things that always jumps to my mind about him, because he did that anti-smoking PSA that, you know, under the conditions they'll only air it after he died, and they did, and I know my parents really creeped the shit out when that happened, but I was too young to know any better.
It's really kind of a shame nowadays that we talk about growing old, and we talk about things that there are actors out there that generations are starting to forget.
And Yul Brynner's one of them.
One of them that people will still remember Cary Grant. They still remember Clark Gable. But
there's that middle ground. We're not far enough away from them to where people...
And he's one of those that people are starting to forget. And it's kind of a shame.
Yep. Okay. Comments, Christopher?
It's certainly one of the better remakes ever made, but I didn't make my list because one of my criteria was that you had to be at least as good as the original. And while it's a great film for the reasons that you guys cite, I just don't think it's better than Seven Samurai. So,
oh, well, that's a tall order.
Yeah, that was just,
but I'm
just
biased
my own,
on that, so.
just my own criterion.
Excellent. What is your number four?
Number four for me, there it is, The Departed.
That's crazy. That's my number four as well.
I still haven't seen it. I saw the original. I saw
Internal Affairs.
And
Christopher, I'm sure you have some, you know, some nice articulate things to say about it. Let me get my thing out of the way, and you can go. Because this is really simple. The thing that added to film for me is I would have never in a million years have seen Internal Affairs if I hadn't seen The Departed and thought it was really freaking cool. Then everyone's all like, the Internal Affairs is really fucking better. And I went and saw it. And I really...
Infernal Affairs.
Infernal Affairs, excuse me. And it was really good. And that's basically what it gave to me, is that, you know, it brought out awareness in a film that not a lot of people are aware of. You know, obviously Martin Scorsese is very big on, you know, you always look at his, you know, top film list and there's shit nobody ever heard about. And there's like three prints in existence. And this is one of those ones that, you know, he's like, I really like this. I'm going to remake it, you know, with this different angle. And then it made people aware of it. And now I think that it's got a good second life. Excuse me. Now that it's,
it won the Oscar.
What did?
It didn't. It
what? Departed? Yeah, yeah. It won. It won picture and director and stuff like that. But you know, it, because of all that, because of the publicity there, it made people go out and, you know, search down this, you know, this little film, the little film that could, and you know, it's cool. So I'm sorry about that, Christopher. Now, why do you like it so much?
Well, it shows off a lot of the elements I think that you need to have a good remake. First of all, being made by a master filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
and it's also a translation of a film from another culture. And, you know, in the Hong Kong elements of it that it loses, it gets replaced by something that I think Scorsese does better than maybe any other filmmaker. And that's putting in elements of real life mobsters and gangsters, because, you know, working in the whole thinly veiled Whitey Bulger angle mm-hmm. into it all. And I just look back at, good, my goodness, what a cast. You know, it's DiCaprio showing another element that he's capable of. It's Jack Nicholson, and for once in the last 20 years, he's not just being Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, that was so refreshing, wasn't it?
You know, I mean, it's Mark Wahlberg playing one of two roles that he can actually successfully pull off. You know,
he was really good in that movie.
There's Dirk Diggler and Street Punk from Boston.
Yeah.
And I know I'm forgetting, I'm leaving out a lot of...
Well, there's Matt Damon.
Who I normally just drive, I just despise beyond all reason, but nailed it in that movie.
Yeah, he was a slimy son of a bitch. Martin Sheen was in it, or
that's who I was trying.
Yeah, Martin Sheen. He actually replaced Robert De Niro last minute. So I found him. He was good, but I did find him a little bit of a clunky fit, and I could have seen Robert De Niro playing that role. But yeah, it's Liev Schreiber was in it, I believe. It's got a fantastic cast, really well directed. It's one of those movies that's fun to watch people with, because it definitely has those punctuation moments in it that you just kind of want to see how people react to.
I'm terrified to watch it.
Nah.
Well, okay. I won't spoil it since we have somebody who hasn't seen here. But yeah,
no. I've seen the original Infernal Affairs.
Oh, okay. Well, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a film that is actually not afraid to go for the grown-up 1970s, not happy, shiny ending.
And on top of that, it's not long and drawn out, and he gets to say his, you know, and I always love, no, he's like in the middle of a sentence, turns around, gets his fucking head blown off. I mean, yeah. it's like, I mean, it was something else to see in a theater.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my feelings on Scorsese are widely known. I'm hard pressed to think of a Scorsese movie I've seen that I actually like, and so that's what has kept me away from The Departed.
It's a good movie.
I don't want to subject myself to any more Scorsese than I absolutely have to.
I don't get that. I think he's such a, you know, he's a really good filmmaker, but I am
a movie snob, and I don't like Martin Scorsese.
I like him as a film preservationist, as a face of film, as much as I like him as a filmmaker. And
yeah, I do like. I have no problems with the man.
He thanked Christopher Lee at the Golden Globes this week. You know, he won the Golden Globe, right?
Who?
Scorsese for Hugo.
Good for him.
Yeah, and he thanked Christopher Lee in his acceptance speech. That was pretty sweet.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, Scorsese, I admit the guy's a talented filmmaker, but he just does movies that I just don't like. I just can't get into him. I try, and it just...
Even his non-traditional stuff?
I just don't like it.
You know, like Aviator and Kings of Comedy and crap like that. You don't like that stuff either? Huh, you're weird.
You know, and it's not lack of trying. I recognize the guy is talented. I mean, I'm not mad he has an Oscar. No, I mean, the guy has had an impact on film. I just, my personal taste on him is I haven't seen a movie of his that I like.
Well, I guess. Sucks to be you. Okay.
And I've seen all the standard ones that people lose sight. I've seen Raging Bull. I've seen Taxi Driver.
I'm glad I saw Raging Bull once. I never need to see it again. It was a great performance
Seen Goodfellas and Casino, and I'm like, I just can't stand any of them.
You're weird.
Yeah.
Huh. Anything to add, Christopher?
And on that note, I hate sunshine and laughter.
Yeah. Fun's no good either.
Here we go.
I hate fun.
To my number three, and going completely on the opposite end of the spectrum from...
the Muppets!
No. I wish. No. Not the although Muppets Christmas Carol was fantastic.
Yeah.
Moving to my number three, opposite end of the spectrum of Martin Scorsese, it's the J.J. Abrams remake of Star Trek.
It's my number two.
Star Trek. All right. And that, I'm amazed it's your number two.
I'll get to that after you talk.
I really enjoyed this movie. I'm a Star Trek fan. I don't consider myself a Trekkie by any stretch of the word. Although I did have when I was a kid, I on Halloween did dress up in a Star Trek Next Generation uniform.
Nerd.
Yes. This movie just did such a great job of, like I said, it's the reverence of the original material, but also opened up new doors to do new cooler stuff. And I'm excited about the next one to see what they do with, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch and that sort of thing. And the old one, the 2009 Star Trek, just had a great cast to it. It had, you know, really perfect casting for characters that you say. Because we used to do a segment on here called Casting Couch.
Right.
And, it's that sort of dream casting type of thing for characters in movies. And this movie really hit the nail on the head with a lot of their casting. It's like, you know, Carl Urban as Bones. It's just so much fun. And, and Simon Pegg, I just want Simon Pegg to have work all the time.
Yep.
So, the 2009 Star Trek was a great revival of the series of the genre. It made it much more, just accessible to this generation, and it's nice to see new life breathed into it with a real, I think, a really talented director and writer in J.J. Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's my number three.
Well, I picked it as my number two because I have two main reasons. The first one was it did the impossible. It made me like a Star Trek movie. I've seen all the tentpole Star Trek movies. I've seen Wrath of Khan and the one with the whales and the one in all, and I've seen all those. I get it. I see why people like them. It's not for me. It's like Ethan and Scorsese. You know, I get why people like them. It's not my thing. But I did really, really, really dig this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun to watch. But the reason why it made my remake list and why it hit so high on my remake list is, you know, short of something like The Color of Money, which is a loose remake, kind of sequel, kind of thing, A Color of Money, I can't think of any other remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, that actually addresses the fact that it's...
The Hustler?
The Hustler, excuse me.
Yeah.
What'd I say?
You just said Color of Money again.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Color of Money is like a loose remake sequel of The Hustler. But this is the only remake, reboot that I could think of that actually addresses the fact and points out that this has all happened before, and it's a remake, and it's the only one where you actually have a, you know, and I think he might even be an ambassador in the movie, but he's the ambassador of the original series was Spock. Only he's not just, you know, in there, you know, hey, look at me, remember me. No, he's actually in there as Spock, addressing the fact that shit was like this, now it's like this, and it came down to a really, you know, really, really. I thought it was a fun movie. I started watching Next Gen, and, you know, once again, I get it. I see why people like it. I got bored with it and quit watching it. One of the main things that did it for me was the goddamn techno babble. And I think that if, you know, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie was made, you know, by whoever directed tons of this other Star Trek shit, the guy that sword that guy has, the Kumar guy, that sword would have been explained how the goddamn thing works, and you know like the gravity and this and that. And this is a sci-fi movie that's kind of set in like an action movie world, and it also addresses the whole. Like I said, I like the fact it addresses that it's a remake in the movie in the story.
It's an accessibility issue.
Yeah.
It made it accessible to people today.
Without, like me.
Because Star Trek has really become a joke. I mean, the last movies, only Star Trek fans are going to go, we're seeing them. This one opened the door to new people seeing it.
Right. I mean, like,
it made it look appealing.
And like when it comes down to it, you know, this movie was, you know, I was surprised that I liked it as much as I did. And I'm more worried about the sequel than looking forward to it. Because, you know, this one, you know, blindsided me. I didn't see myself liking it. And I really got my doubts I'll like the new one. I hope I do. But, you know, I definitely see it.
I think they're rushing the next one out, which is...
Doesn't seem like it.
So, that's good.
Anything to add, Christopher?
Well, let me be clear, first of all. There are remakes that are quite simply affronts to God. Mm-hmm. There are invitations for the Lord to flood us all off this planet again. Like, say, the Wild Wild West movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I don't put...
Speaking of my number two, I'm kidding.
I don't put the Star Trek movie into that category because it was made by people who clearly had some care and some degree of talent. But here's what I lament about the reboot. There is this new breed of Hollywood film that they get every single detail right about the source material they're adapting, except the ultimate point. And no two films define this better for me than Watchmen and Star Trek. And here's the thing. The thing to me that makes Star Trek special and worth talking about, other than just as a cheap punchline after 40 years, is the fact that it's thoughtful. The fact that it tries to teach you a moral lesson. And when it's really, 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 really on, will teach you a moral lesson that no other form of entertainment will bring it to you. And what I saw in the remake was it's Star Trek, except with all the ideas cut out of it. And to me, that's just a complete and utter waste of everyone's time. I mean, there are 700 other dumb science fiction movies you could have made with extreme orbital diving and things like that. And to slap a Star Trek name on just another dumb science fiction film, admittedly a modestly entertaining one and not without its charms, but it just seems a real, real waste to put Star Trek on it. I mean, it's like taking an above-average drama and calling it Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems like a complete and total waste of an opportunity. And, you know, like I said, I can't hate it the way that I hate Wild Wild West, but it just... It's like, gee, do you have to pick everything out of my childhood, bring it back, and make it dumber?
No, because just stuff from your childhood still there, dude. It's for the new generation, and it's also for the knuckle draggers like me that I don't want to see a Star Trek movie because I don't care how a teleporter works. You know, because ultimately it doesn't. But that's what it feels like to me when I watch Star Trek.
Well, if you watch the 90s shows, God knows most of them suffer from way too much of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what made the original work is there's some throwaway nod to technology occasionally, but it ultimately, at least the best of them, boil down to dealing with human issues, human problems, and human ideas. I mean, God, how many episodes of the classic Trek get solved by a punch in the nose or luring somebody into bed, almost to a comical degree? But yeah, I mean, you really don't start overdosing on the technobabble until you get to the 90s shows. And with the exception of Deep Space Nine, which I consider to be the underrated gem of that catalog, you can flush them all. I mean, God bless Ken Hite. He's the one who coined the phrase, after Kirk, there is only void. So yeah, I mean, if you want to hate on Next Gen, I'll be right there throwing fuel on that fire. But you know, I mean, remake one of their movies if all you want to do is a big dumb action film. You know, don't go after my Trek if all you want to do is make a big dumb action movie.
Didn't you just say a majority of these movies were, or excuse me, these shows were the problems were solved with a punch to a nose or getting a girl into bed?
Quite a few of them. Yeah.
Well, where's the deep and thoughtfulness there?
Well, I'm just saying that in the best of them, come up with very human solutions, and I'm using throwing punches and having sex as the two most human activities I can think of. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, the original series had its share of cookie cutter episodes, but then
it had those
gems like, you know, City on the Edge of Forever, Squire Gothos, and things that.
Yeah, yeah. When the original was bad, it was gloriously, spectacularly awful. But I'm just saying the best episodes of Trek you can't argue with, you can't touch.
Sure. My argument though is that the original series was made in the 60s. And television was a very different...
I don't think that's an argument. That's probably fact.
Sure. But this is my argument as to why.
Oh, there's more.
Is the original series was done in the 60s, and TV was way different than how movies were in the 60s and today. So I mean, I don't think the movie would have done nearly as well if they had tried to put that deep philosophical meaning. I think that really would have turned people off, because that's not what people want when they're going to the movies nowadays. Is they're wanting escapism, and I thought that this movie did a great job of having some reverence for the original, showing some respect to it, and then going off on its own path.
I don't think you have to stand on an audience's chest and beat them over the head with a message. I mean, Dark Knight, some directors think
you have to do that.
Yes, they do. But Dark Knight made over $200 million, and it's one of the greatest meditations on privacy, the role of the state and the individual and vigilantism. I mean, that's a serious grown-up movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it made over $200 million because it's also pretty freaking cool.
Made a lot more than that, didn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Last I heard, it was over 200 million.
I thought it was closer to a billion, but okay.
It may be once you figure in worldwide. But what I'm saying is, you can do a wildly successful idea and put thoughtfulness into it. And if a movie is really freaking cool and presents me with some thought-provoking ideas, that to me is what was great about the original Trek. I fell in love with the phasers and the aliens long before I really figured out what all was going on these shows. And I'm just saying, if you're going to slap Star Trek on it, especially if you're going to do it with Kirk and Spock, do your orbital skydiving just so the 12-year-olds in the audience will feel like they got something out of the movie. But can it be a little thoughtful? If you're going to spend a kajillion dollars on this and get some people involved in this who obviously seem to care about their craft, could you put a little something in there for those of us who still have more than 3 functioning brain cells? That's all I have to say about it.
All right. Fair enough. I thoroughly enjoyed that one. So
I liked it better than I liked Star Trek.
That's
the problem.
It accomplished its goal of.
It got the knuckle draggers like me there, which is fine.
It got people who don't like Star Trek to like Star Trek.
Well, I like that movie.
And that should tell you something.
Yeah. There you go. and I will totally 100% agree with you. Deep Space Nine is totally awesome. It is the redheaded stepchild of Star Trek that not enough people appreciate.
Very, very much so.
I will totally stand by my choice of Captain Sisko as the best Star Trek captain ever. He punched Q. Come on.
Well, I tell you, if I can't go with Kirk, Sisko's an easy one for me.
That's true.
Hmm.
That's true. And I'm looking. Dark Knight actually grossed domestically $533 million. So, I mean, and it's a great film.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
I'm from Southwest Virginia. You know how I am with numbers.
Yeah. We're from Kansas. We make up stuff.
Yeah. And then we look at the interwebs. Am I onto my... What?
Past 10, I got to take off my shoes.
Gotcha. Are we on to my number 3?
Yes.
My number 3 is surprising because I think at one point I said, I'm giving away a future show because my number 1 is this movie. But it's actually, my number 3 is the, what year is that, some bitch? 2006 Martin Campbell film, Casino Royale. I really like it because, once again, it does the same thing that I
wouldn't call it a remake at all.
It's a reboot. Which this show is remake. Yeah. This show is remake slash reboot.
I really tried to steer clear of the Bond stuff, and I love Casino Royale. I love Casino Royale. So.
But at the same time, every goddamn James Bond movie ever made is a remake, kinda.
Oh, yeah.
But my thing about it is, I'm gonna be repeating what I said with Batman Begins. Is it basically stripped all the damage that had been done over the past 35 years?
It stripped all the bullshit out.
It stripped all the bullshit out, and then just put down. Like a good sleek Bond movie.
Lasers from the sky thing with diamonds in your face, and went, okay, fuck it, no more ice palaces.
No, we're gonna get
on this in reality.
We got a Bond that we think might murder us in a dark bathroom.
From a guy who still enjoyed Dying of the Day. Okay?
It is what it is.
Classic Bond movies are great escapism.
Actually, Dying of the Day was the one that made me give up on Bond altogether. And then this movie came out, and I got drug kicking, screaming to see it, and I really liked it, and I went and saw.
Die Another Day. Wasn't that Halle Berry movie?
Yep.
Yeah.
That
had James Bond in it.
Cameo in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And, this movie made me go see the Quantum of Solace. What's the Bond Identity, basically. Yeah. And it's not horrible, but...
Oh, I love the Bourne movies, and that one's... Casino Royale just...
It's awesome. I love it.
Did a fucking great job.
I love it. I expect...
the best Bond.
Without a doubt, we've talked the hell out of that also, which is also why I don't want to go on too much about this. But yeah, stripped out all the bullshit and just once again made Bond interesting instead of invincible. So I like that about it. So anything to say, Christopher?
I'm just sitting here thinking, like, wow, talk about a film better than the original. I think we would be hard pressed to find with something that epitomizes it more than that choice.
Well, that much is true. I think the original has its quirks and its charms in its own dumbass way, but obviously this one's way better.
I haven't seen a Woody Allen movie I like either.
He's like a fourth tier supporting character, for Christ's sakes.
I know.
It's like calling, you know.
Directed.
No, he didn't direct it. That was directed by Val Guest and Ken Hughes, the 1967 version. No, he was Jimmy Bond, and you know he was like, you know, fourth tier supporting character.
Yeah, I know.
But you know it's stupid, and I'm not saying it isn't, but I have certainly seen worse movies.
Oh yeah,
and you know it is what it is. I used to own it. You know, yeah. I used to own it when I had all the Bond movies because it's just like, you know, why would I not spend $4 to have that dumbass thing sitting on my shelf? And it is what it is, and I'm not singing its praises.
Spend $3 and get that.
Yeah, I did. That's pretty cool. But I picked it from number 3. I expected it to be higher, but when it came down to it, I couldn't do it. But I do really, really enjoy it.
Nice. Now we're down to my number 2. We're gonna get into.
Did I get my number 3?
Yeah.
I didn't get my number 3.
What was your number 3?
Oh, okay. Thank you. My number.
I'm sorry.
My number 3 is the 78 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the Philip Kaufman version.
Okay, it's one with Donald Sutherland, right?
Yes.
I haven't actually seen that one. I've seen the original, and I've seen, what was it, the 90-91 remake, something like that?
That was later than that one. Well, at any rate.
Something like that, the later one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Now, I mean, for all the films that get put out, touted as being updated for our times, and usually that just means the director trying to shoehorn some sort of silly, trendy, contemporary issue into a classic film that had no business being remade.
Yeah.
This is one time that it actually lives up to the billing. You know, I mean, the original film, good God, what can you say about it this time? I mean, it could be the greatest film ever made about communism, the greatest McCarthyism, or both. It mm-hmm. works on that many levels. And then here comes the 78 remake, which obviously has no business being any good whatsoever. I mean, good gosh, remaking Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
And it just so perfectly taps into that late 70s zeitgeist of alienation and things like that. And here's the funny thing. OK, by all rights, that should be as dated as Saturday Night Fever. Mm-hmm. Fine film on its own terms, but just so much of its time. But yet that feeling of alienation, the feeling that we are isolated even in our own own communities and own homes, as stuff like the internet and things like that have been creeping in and you know, making us in some ways more isolated from our fellow human beings more directly. And we're going to be bombarded with fear and mistrust of people from the media. It's a film that's actually becoming more relevant, maybe more so than sometimes the original.
Yeah.
And what a magnificent work that is, if there's any truth to what I'm saying here. So a well done Philip Kaufman.
Oh, yeah. And one thing I've noticed looking at this list and about remakes in general like that is, for the most part, most remakes are not as good as the original, or they're pretty bad. But occasionally that works to the remakes, that sort of thought process works to the betterment of the remake, in that sometimes, you know, movie producers or, you know, the powers that be don't pay that much attention to it. So if you get a clever writer or a good director in there, they can sneak in some stuff that is relevant that actually works and updates it for a modern audience. And that sounds like that's what you're talking about with this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. Totally fair.
I have nothing to add. I haven't seen it. So
nice.
Well, that was your number 3. I went before you, so it's Ethan's number 2.
Yes, my number 2. Getting into two movies that I really wanted to talk about. My number 2 is sometimes you have other directors remaking other directors, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes you get the same director remaking his own stuff,
right? Like Hitchcock and
yes.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's one of my favorite Hitchcock movies. It's the 1956 The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is a remake of his original 1934 film.
I do think that's one of those things that people like. Well, a lot of people like to get, like, people like, and like us, we get all high and mighty about the 98. You know, how dare somebody remake Hitchcock? Like, fucking Hitchcock remade Hitchcock.
Exactly.
So shut up. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I've seen both versions. I've seen the original black and white. It's a good movie. You know, it is what it is. It's 1934.
He improved on
movie. But then he comes out in 1956, with this movie starring Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day, and it's in color. It's Hitchcock at, you know, Hitchcock at sort of his peak, you know, and they're in that golden era of Hitchcock where he was just kicking out awesome movies. And this one came out, and it's the epitome of a brilliant Hitchcock type of movie, as Hitchcock loved doing the everyman hero thrown into situations that are, you know, beyond him. And this movie does that and does it well because you get this just brilliance of Jimmy Stewart in there, mm-hmm. combined with...
I really like Jimmy Stewart, especially after the war.
Yeah,
he got really dark after the war.
And combine him with Alfred Hitchcock, one of the greatest filmmakers of ever. All time. And you get this movie. You get movies like Rear Window, which is great. But if we're talking remakes. It's for me. It's The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah.
It has that classic scene. It's a very Hitchcock.
I'm glad you're not talking the Bill Murray one.
No, The Man Who Knew Too Much. The classic scene at the end where Doris Day is singing the song,
right.
Okay, Sarah, Sarah, really reminded me of another Hitchcock movie, you know, the 39 Steps, you know, I mean.
I really enjoy that one.
It's just Hitchcock sort of doing Hitchcock, but, you know, if anyone else would have done it, it would just be horrible. And, you know, Hitchcock said basically, well, there's something here, I want to do this, but I want to do it with this actor that I love working with who I know can just take this role and knock it out of the park. And for me, Man Who Knew Too Much is just one of those great, often underrated, often forgotten Hitchcock movies out there, because most people think, you know, North by Northwest, Psycho, The Birds, but not a lot of people remember The Man Who Knew Too Much.
And oh, yeah.
It's just absolutely fantastic. So.
I have nothing to add to that, but I do want to talk a little bit about Hitchcock, because this, you got me thinking about this earlier when we were talking about how, you know, everybody knows they're Clark Gables and they're Cary Grants and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they hold them at a reverence for higher than when they were alive. And I think that's really, 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 really true about Hitchcock, because Hitchcock, you know, he was a fantastic, great filmmaker. I am not trying to speak ill of him at all. Mm-hmm. But I do think that people try to put him on the wrong pedestal now, because a lot of people like to think of him as, you know, like this auteur, this artiste. And right. No, the dude, well, you know, he was a blockbuster maker. You know, he made popcorn pictures.
Well, the guy had a great sense of humor.
He did. And he doesn't seem like that, but he does.
I guess it was a trailer, teaser, something. He used to do, like, the little
thing
where Hitchcock himself would talk to you about his movies.
Yeah.
He did one for Psycho. And the
classic
one for Psycho is so great, because every time he's giving you a tour of the Bates Motel. Have you seen it?
Yeah. It was on the DVD.
Yeah. He's giving you a tour of the Bates Motel, and he stops at every time he passes by. He goes, The bathroom.
Yep.
And then continues on without showing it to you. And it I mean, that just sort of embodies why Hitchcock is great to me. And
yeah, I just...
This movie is just fantastic.
I just wanted to point that out, because I love Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. You know, but a lot of people like to think of him as a... I'm trying to think of a modern-day equivalent of what people are wrong about. I don't know, Fellini. He's like a modern... No, he's more like a modern-day Spielberg. You know, somebody that, you know, that makes these popcorn pictures. And a lot of people, you know... Yeah. And I don't think he would like that. I don't think a lot... I mean, I guess he might be, okay, cool, they think I'm a good filmmaker, but he was an entertainer. He wasn't a, you know, an artist trying to talk about social morals. And no, I mean, he just wanted to entertain people. And I really dig him. I thought he's a really good director.
But I think it's fair to say, though, that if there is some larger relevance than other than just making a darn fine film, it's incidental. You know, you could certainly draw a lot of critical conclusions about, say, Rear Window,
yeah,
something like that. But again, it's tangential to making just a darn good film.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not like that desert movie that sucks so much, The English Patient. It's not like that. Yeah. It's not like, okay, I get it. You're really good with the camera and I want to shoot myself, but, you know,
right.
No, you know, Hitchcock, you know, he makes these movies with the, you know, with the underlying things, but he doesn't beat you over the head with it. And he also entertains the hell out of you while you're doing it. So, sorry, I just wanted to point that out, because I don't think the Hitchcock would like that. You know, I think he'd want to first and foremost be thought of as an entertainer, but I could be wrong. So that was your number two. My number two, I already went off on my little tangent about, because it was Star Trek, and I have nothing to add about it. So what's your number two?
Yeah, Christopher.
Why do I keep getting out of sequence?
Brain damage?
I guess so. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, my number two is the 2010 Coen Brothers remake of True Grit.
You know, I forgot about that. I don't really think it would upset my list at all.
I haven't seen the original, so I left it off.
Yeah.
I have nothing to compare it to.
I certainly like it better than the John Wayne movie.
Well, I'm pleased. This is not intended as an assault on the John Wayne version, which is perfectly fine.
It is perfectly fine.
It's John Wayne.
I have no problems with it whatsoever. But, you know, to me, the thing there's almost something maddening about the True Grit remake is because most remakes are they're not only remaking a film, it's they don't even realize all the times they're going back to a property that existed in some other medium. You're doing another version of something that used to be a book or a graphic novel or a radio show or whatever. And of all of the reasons that you could possibly use to justify a remake, going back to the original source material is always one of the best and most worthy ones. And it's so rare that they even attempt that. I mean, the great thing about the remake of True Grit, other than the fact that you have a couple of three really fantastic performances in it, mm-hmm. is the fact that what makes it so fresh and worthwhile and original is all the stuff they bring back from the book that got lost in the John Wayne version.
Agreed.
And other than, I probably could strain and come up with another example, but just thinking about John Carpenter when he redid The Thing, who tried to go back to the Campbell short story Who Goes There. It's so rare to find a filmmaker that even tries to use that as an opportunity to pay closer homage to the original source material. And it's such a shame because True Grit is a great example about how that can make a remake into a rewarding and worthwhile experience.
Very good. Anything to add, Ethan?
Nope.
You haven't seen it?
I've seen the Coen Brothers one.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
I have not seen the original.
I don't have anything particular to add other than I love the movie. I own the movie on Blu-ray. I watch it often. And I do much prefer it to the John Wayne movie because it's a John Wayne movie. I mean,
one can make the argument that if you've seen a John Wayne movie, you have seen all of the John Wayne movies.
You know, it's a shaky argument, but there's some
True Grit it would probably be like.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I do. I adore this one. It's a good choice, Christopher. Very good choice.
Definite testament to the Coen brothers. I mean, if you're remaking a movie that has John Wayne in it, you know, I mean,
the one he got his Oscar for, no less.
Yeah, I mean, it's John Wayne. Mm-hmm. It's John Wayne, you know, is John Wayne. He is John Wayne in and of himself.
Yeah.
Right. But they chose not to go with a someone who is effectively John Wayne. They went with someone who doesn't really play those types of roles. You know, is the man's man, John Wayne, you know, swaggering in and punching the guy.
Yeah.
They decided to go with Jeff Bridges, you know, who definitely is not the hero type.
He's not that guy.
Yeah. And so that sort of spoke to me as far as their talent. So. Mm.
Cool. Well, good choice. I guess we're down to our favorite sitses. So, Ethan.
All right. This is a movie that I saw the remake, and then when I found out it was a remake, I went back and tracked down the original.
Mm-hmm.
And the remake is miles and miles better. And it's a movie that I'm interested to see what you guys think about it. It is a remake of a 1987 Scott Glenn film directed by Eli Chorquay. He has a really wacky last name, this director. But it is the 2004 Tony Scott Denzel Washington Man on Fire.
I really dig that movie, and I didn't know it was a remake until today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found out it was a remake by watching the extra features on the disc.
I think I caught it on HBO one day. Cool movie.
It's the same movie, more or less. I mean, he's playing Scott Glenn plays Creasy.
Mm-hmm.
In the original, it's set in, I think it's Colombia. I think it's Colombia. I can't remember off the top of my head. It might be the Middle East. It's been a long time since I watched it. But Man on Fire, Tony Scott, Denzel Washington, was sort of their, I think it was the first Denzel Washington, Tony Scott collaboration. I
mean, around there, yeah.
Because there's been several at this point. This movie sort of does what, sort of going off on a limb here, is this movie does what The Punisher refuses to do, which is make a main character who's not afraid to get his hands dirty. This movie really shines with Dakota Fanning.
Yeah.
It's one of the first times
A really intense child performance.
Yeah. It was one of the first times I remember seeing her in something. I think it predates War of the Worlds that she did.
Oh, good Lord, yes. that was probably 5 years before.
Sure, fine, whatever. But that's when people really remember her from. But I remember from this because she did such a great emotional job. And Denzel Washington obviously is a fantastic actor. I mean, the guy's got, what, two Academy Awards now? and this was a movie that I think he should have been nominated for. I mean, if he got it for Training Day, I mean, easily, yeah. I think this is a better performance.
Sure.
But this movie sort of, it's interesting to sit back and analyze because Tony Scott directed it, and Tony Scott used to do, I mean, this is the guy who did The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I like The Last Boy Scout.
No, I love that. But you see those two movies together, I would definitely not say they're the same director.
Oh, well.
Yeah, he's come a long way and a really.
His visual style is absolutely all over The Last Boy Scout, though. The smoky stuff, the oversaturated lenses, stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I agree. But. I think seeing those movies side by side, you would not really say, at least they're the same guy, because, I mean, it's two
different. Not the same guy, but knowing what a Tony Scott movie is, yes.
But Man on Fire, I think, has the great story. It has the not necessarily a happy ending type of thing.
No.
It has, really. You know, this great realism to it, this great grittiness, and it took what was a good concept, and apparently Tony Scott was actually attached to direct the original back in 1987.
Yep.
But had to step off it to do other projects, and he came back around and he did this one, and it's an amazing movie. I think it's one of those movies that not a lot of people know about, not a lot of people really love, and it's absolutely, you know, something I think people should check out.
I did like it. It's not on my list, and I haven't seen the original, and I didn't really know that it was a remake until like a couple of hours ago, even. And I did like it. I still don't think it would have made my list. I find it. The story's good. It's a good story, real good story. But I just found it much more visually interesting than maybe the story. And it's cool. It's fun to look. I mean, it's fun. It's good to look at. It's a very well crafted, good looking film, and I like it. And it's been a while since I've seen it, but I did like it. Have you seen this one, Christopher? Do you have anything to add?
I don't think I could call it the greatest remake of all time, because there were some good things about it. I agree with you, it's visually interesting. Dakota Fanning is extraordinary, but you look at Training Day and you see what Denzel is really, really capable of as an actor, and then there's just far too many movies where he just gets paid to show up and be Denzel Washington. Mm-hmm. And I just, this one just, it didn't get me enough out of that zone to really make much of an impression. Just my take on it.
Sure. And to me, this movie, I don't think he shows up and is Denzel Washington in this movie at all.
So. Certainly not to the degree that he walked through a lot of his other films, like the
Virtuosity.
The worst one, the one where he's in a hospital screaming God, it's him screaming how bad HMOs are for a couple of hours.
I thought you were going to be talking about The Bone Collector.
There's that one too.
We could go on and on.
Top 10 shitty Denzel Washington movies. Yeah. Yes. I have a rule, and I think if anybody's around me when I talk about movies, I say it, and I may have said it on the show, and I may have said it to Ethan, but my rule is I never let somebody's personal bullshit affect what I think about them as a performer, because ultimately I know it's cheap and it just lets me, you know, not have any investment in anything, but I don't ever let that affect, like, what, you know, like if I think they're a good actor or director or whatever, you know, like, obviously I'm not for statutorily raping somebody, but I do find what's his face,
Roman Polanski
a good director, and what's his face? Russell Crowe's a jerk off. You know, you shouldn't throw a phone at somebody, but he does sometimes do a good movie. Denzel Washington is one of those people that really pushes it to the line for me. I cannot stand that fucking guy outside of camera, but he's such a good actor 85% of the time that, you know, I overlook it, but I just don't want to, because he's one of those people that, I mean, I don't want him to die. But it's going to happen one day, right? And I'm looking forward to that time when he dies, because I want to hear the horror stories about this guy after he's gone. I don't want him to die. I don't wish him to die. But I want to hear the horror stories, because I've heard horror stories about him now that, you know, it just like, and this is what they're willing to let out. I mean, because by all accounts, he's like amongst the most difficult people to work with in Hollywood. He's amongst the most joyless people in Hollywood.
I think you may have broken Christopher.
Sorry. I mean, I was just kidding. But no.
Anything you preface with, I don't want him to die.
I don't want him to die. But what I'm saying is I'd be interesting to hear the horror stories after there's no...
Maybe just maimed a little.
But yeah, like in John, like the Bone Collector. Just cut his foot off so he can't come after me. But he's just, and he plays the race card a lot.
Yeah.
And I find him obnoxious, but he's such a good actor that I'm able to keep to my rule, but he's the one that pushes me the hardest on it. So, but I do like that movie. It's pretty good. If I remember right, it was originally like cultivated as a movie for Brando, and it seems like I want to say I read that or heard that or something, and you know he was all fucking Brando about it and didn't do it, and it's a good little movie. I like it. I haven't seen it long enough to really comment too much on it. But sorry, man, I didn't mean to go off on that.
All right, Christopher, what's your number one?
Yeah, what's the best?
Well, this one caught me off guard. When I looked at it in context of my other choices, this one caught me off guard, which is really strange to me because this is the film that made me want to do this list to begin with. And it sort of breaks most of the other rules that I came up with as I was examining my list. Like one thing I noticed is there's a lot of horror and sci-fi on my list. And it got me thinking about, you know, why does horror and sci-fi remake so well? And I guess because by the nature of it, it loans itself to advances in movie technology. You can do better special effects. And, you know, they're inherently imaginative films. They sort of beg to be reimagined in new and creative ways. Meanwhile, a straight drama, if you do that right the first time, what in the world are you going to change? I mean, get better performances? You know, dramas aren't all about settings. Updating it's not really
going
to add
well,
much.
Well, going after better performances isn't exactly a poor goal.
It is, but, you know, if you nail it the first time.
Well.
You know, if you have a genuinely good film. Now, we could do a whole show on why don't they go back to dramas that were just okay the first time and remake those.
Mm-hmm.
Try to do those with better actors. They're always going after the films that pretty much nailed it the first time for the most part. But this, again, breaks all those rules. It's not a horror and sci-fi film. It's actually the third version of a story. How often is the third version of a story the good one? And it's quite honestly, I think one of the greatest films ever made, and that would be the 1941 version of the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah. I, you know, once again,
I love that movie.
It's one that I didn't really know was a remake until today. And I adore everything about that movie, though.
Well, I tell you, it would not stick in my mind as a remake had it not been for the last standard DVD release, which actually included the two previous ones as extras. And, oh my lord, you don't love the 41 version until you've had to sit through the two predecessors.
Are they that bad?
Well, now if you try hard enough, you can find things in it that you like. Like the 31 version, the Elisha Cook Jr. character, the Wilmer the Gunsel, he gets played by Dwight Frye, who was Renfield in the Bela Lugosi Dracula, and he brings a little more of a psycho edge to it, and that's kind of interesting in and of itself. But the great ending of the 41 version. Okay, you know the stuff that dreams are made of.
Yep.
To give you a comparison, this is how the 31 version ends. It ends with Sam Spade going to visit Bridget O'Shaughnessy in prison, and they exchange a few really obvious, unnecessary, let's hammer home the ending of this movie to the audience one last time. And then he's starting to leave. And as he does, he leans backward into frame and goes, "See you around, baby." And it's just, you want to punch every single person attached to that movie just for the last five unnecessary seconds of that film. Okay. Now, the second version is titled Satan Met a Lady. It's the 36 version, and they start with the not terrible idea of making Betty Davis the Bridget O'Shaughnessy character. And then they just sort of went to hell from there because the idea after that was to make it a screwball comedy.
Mhm.
And, you know, it's
That's a horrible
things.
Idea.
Yeah, it is. You can understand why this isn't really wasn't high on Betty Davis's resume.
Mm-hmm.
And so, really, the 41, it's a darn near perfect film.
It's up there.
And really, seriously, of all the films that I have on my list, not only do I consider this to be the best remake of all time, it's the only one that is, again, the third version of filming the same story. And it's so good and so creative, it actually creates a film genre on its own, because I think most people would agree with me. This is your first true film noir.
The people would argue with you, but we'll leave that aside.
Yes, well, I've written a book about it, so I win.
Okay.
I'm kidding, joke.
It's certainly the one that put it on the. There's films that you can argue about that, in retrospect, they were film noirs, but this is the first one that, like, okay, this is something. This is what are we going to call this? You know, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly like the one that, you know, brought it out in the open. So no, I adore this movie. I'm sure it showed up on my film noir list. I can't say off the top of my head, but I adore it. And once again, I didn't know there was other iterations of it until today.
Yeah.
So, cool.
Mm-mm-mm. Well, you know, if you're ever in the mood for some pain, you know, go hunt up the other two versions.
I will watch any movie once.
Well, they're worth seeing just for the curiosity value.
And I bet you I could sit through them just for that alone. When we get down to my number one, this is a movie that's had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 and a half, because there's a remake in the there's a remake in the works right now. But there's 3.5 4.5 iterations of it thus far. And you know, I'm not like I'm moving away from the whole fanfare thing. I chose the 1986 Little Shop of Horrors. Well documented as I love that movie. Get rid of that. Who cares that I like it? I do really, really like it. But we're not talking about that I like it. The thing that I like about it is, you know, making this list and, like, really, you know, peeling back the layers of, you know, what makes a good remake and a bad remake, and, you know, what remakes need to be made, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It led me to the point that is an absurd argument. It's absolutely absurd that, you know, no, we don't, that a movie doesn't need to be, it doesn't need to be remade, but it also certainly doesn't need to be made in the first place. I mean, I don't want to live in the world without, you know, the Maltese Falcon, or, you know, many of these movies. But ultimately they don't matter when it comes down to it, because they're a form of entertainment that doesn't always make a huge bit of a difference. So I just really thought about this, and I started thinking about the history of this movie and just how utterly fucking absurd the whole thing is, because it started with a short story written in 1932 called Green Thoughts, and I read it. I think it was on one of the DVDs I owned on, like, a PDF form, and then obviously there was the 1960 version done by Roger Corman, with, you know, one of Jack Nicholson's first performances, and by all accounts, that's a terrible movie. I enjoy watching it, but it's terrible. It's terrible.
Jack Nicholson's agent told him to quit.
Yep. Yeah. That's one of those movies that's got a lot of
that agent is probably unemployed.
Yeah. It's one of those movies that has a lot of urban myths around it. Like, a lot of people said that Roger Corman made it on a bet, and that just isn't true. Don't remember where I heard it, where I read about it, but it was because there was some new law they were putting into effect that affected, you know, how they could pay people. And it was the last time, because of the way that Roger Corman made movies, he made them really cheap and stuff, and he'd have to pay these people more, so he wanted, you know, one more under the belt, and so he knocked, I think they filmed it in 2 or 3 days, and paid damn near nothing, and it came out, and it was a modest success. I mean, it didn't change film as we know it or anything like that. And then we get to 1982, when they made a musical version of it. I mean, good God, somebody read a book that's about a plant that eats people, and somebody says, that would make a damn good movie. And then somebody saw that movie, and they're like, you know what, that's a pretty good movie, but God damn it, the plant needs to be singing, so let's go do that on stage. And then, I don't know how familiar people are with the stage version or the original versions of this, but if you've seen the 86 version, you know how it ends. It doesn't end like that in the play. The plant eats everybody and takes over the world, and that's the way that the play happened. And then they made the film that way too, and they go and they make the film, and everyone sees the film. Most people like this movie. Not everyone sucks like Ethan, but I love you anyway. Most people adore this movie, and it's really weird to think about that movie with that original ending, with these characters you genuinely come to care about getting eaten by a goddamn plant and it takes over the world. I mean, that's a downer of an ending, and the test audience is just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And they ended up reshooting it and giving it the Hollywood happy ending. But at this point, you're deluded from the short story that turned into a low budget B movie that turned into a Broadway play down to this, you know, pretty big budget, you know, singing plant movie. And you know, at this point, you know, Frank Oz is like, okay, I'll fucking change it. Who cares at this point? And then I adore this movie. And the funny thing about it is it's in reworking stages again right now. And a director, Declan O'Brien, he's the guy that directed Wrong Turn 3, is going to be making a remake of this movie. And he said it's not going to be musical, and he's going to actually make it dark. And that's kind of my whole point about this is remakes are absurd. But when it comes down to it, films are absurd, and they're there to enjoy. And
a lot of them are just arrogant. You know, it's like, well, I'm going to take this original, and I can do it better.
Yeah.
So.
And this was, to me, this was an exercise in, well, first off, you know, I'm going to keep running with this whole absurd idea I have, but it's like, what's one up the last guy? Okay, it was a weird little book about playing. Oh, fuck that. I'm going to make a weird little movie. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to make a weird musical. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to make a musical movie. I'm going to change the goddamn ending and make it happy. It's absurd, and I love that movie, and that's well established on this show, but I picked as my number one because I think the whole idea is absurd. I think that remaking the film is absurd. I think making films are absurd, and when it comes down to it, nothing matters. It's all good fun, and I find this movie to be awful lot of fun, so I chose as my number one. Anything to add, Ethan or Christopher? I know you hate everything about this movie.
I have nothing to say.
And I don't get that, but you're so weird. I enjoy it. That's where I am. Christopher, no?
Oh, I think I don't love as much as you do, but I definitely agree with you that it's exemplary of a good reason to remake a film. But I will say this. I actually really enjoy the original, and it's all for one reason, is because you have that Charles Griffith script there.
Yeah.
And I've just always found him to be hysterically, mind-bendingly funny. And it's not up. I mean, it's maybe not his best script. You know, I'm a little more fond of, say, you know, Death Race 2000.
Uh-huh.
Maybe his best piece. But still in all, the man was just so wonderfully warped and bent in his sense of humor. And that's one of the times where, just simply because of the time crunch involved, they were basically just had to shoot every bizarre word that he typed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I really enjoy it on like a really Mad Magazine kind of absurdist level. So, I just, you know, this guy doesn't get enough credit for the work that he did in making Roger Corman a household name and making some really fantastic films, which other people took and made millions off of. And I think he died in a hotel room by himself. So, I just want to show Charles Griffith some respect and some love.
Now, I'm below my...
That's how I felt after seeing the movie.
Jeez, dude. You're... There's something dead inside of you, but you know,
not dead enough. Apparently,
I'm down below fighting weight on my knowledge of the 1960 version. But wasn't Charles Griffith in the film also as like a cameo? Of he might have been one of the dental patients or something like that.
I couldn't place him, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit. I've only ever seen pictures of him in his later years, so I couldn't spot him myself.
But that's my point about it, is the reason why you remake a film is because people have fond memories of the original ones, and why not just go wacky and make the plants sing? And, you know, that's what this is all about. It's about being fun, and it's about enjoying it, and Ethan's not dead enough inside, but I do know a lot of people do enjoy this movie, and I'm one of them. It hit my top six films list. But that is my number one. At this point, we're going to run down our top 10 of our favorite remakes and stick a pin in this. Ethan, let's do your list.
Oh, okay.
You're
sorry,
such a...
I was trying to space out and get myself as far away from the little child of horrors as possible.
Dude, shut the hell. Man on Fire is your number one. Jeez.
Uh-huh. Set the plant on fire. My number 10
they
is...
They blew it up.
The, hey, you know, that was the only good thing. My number 10
no
is
soul.
The 1964 Sergio Leone remake of Yojimbo. It's Fistful of Dollars.
Hey, that's my number 9.
Apparently, I have two number 8s instead of number 9. So my first number 8 is the 2002 Gore Verbinski remake of Ringu. It's The Ring.
Horrible. Good Lord. That movie sucks.
Okay. I liked it just fine.
Ringu sucked too, so it's all right.
Sure. It's not a talking plant. It'd
be better if it were.
My second number eight is the 1991 Charles Shire remake of the Spencer Tracy original Father of the Bride.
The Steve Martin one.
Yes.
That's Steve a Martin cute one. Movie.
My number seven is the 1982 John Carpenter remake of The Thing from Another World. It's John Carpenter's The Thing. Then my number six is the 2010 Karate Kid. Number five is 2001 Mean Machine. Number four, the 1960 Magnificent Seven. Number three is the 2009 Star Trek. Number two, the 1956 The Man Who Knew Too Much. And the number one is 2004 Man on Fire.
Cool, cool, cool. Christopher, what's your list look like?
My number 10 was the second adaptation of the classic French novel, The Hands of Warlach. This one was made in 1935 in America under the title of Mad Love, and it was Peter Lorre's American debut. And number 9 was the classic Hammer Horror of Dracula, which we talked about extensively last week. Number 8 was the first color version of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the 1954 Disney version with, again, Peter Lorre. I didn't realize Peter Lorre was all over my list.
Peter Lorre's awesome.
This apparently is the Hitchcock Peter Lorre list, then.
Apparently.
I guess so. And number seven, okay, no Peter Lorre, but hey, Peter Cushing, The Curse of Frankenstein.
I'll put Peter Lorre in there anyway.
Well,
not if you have to get rid of Peter Cushing.
In addition to. He can be his chipper.
He can be his Igor. That'd be perfect.
And six was the 2004 Lady Killers. Six was the 1960 House of Usher. Number four is The Departed. Number three was the 78 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Two, the 2010 True Grit, and number one, the 1941 Maltese Falcon.
Very good. My list sucks, but whatever, except for number one, because that's an awesome movie. My number 10 is the 2007 James Mangold remake of 310 to Yuma. Number nine, Fistful.
It's a good movie.
It's all right.
Yeah.
It's much better than the original.
Well, big
of
time.
What I've seen. I haven't seen the whole thing. That's why I didn't end up on my list, but I did. I really.
The original is what it is, but the remake.
Unless you can get the Blu-ray for like $8.
The new one?
Of the new one.
Yeah. I could have lived without Russell Crowe in that movie. He was too Russell Crowe for me in that movie, but I still liked it.
Beautifully shot.
Sure. Sure was. Yeah, it's the dude that's going to be directing Wolverine 2. James Mangold?
Yeah.
Number eight, the 2010 Karate Kid. Number seven, I'm surprised this didn't show up on your list, but nothing surprises me anymore with you, you soulless bastard. But it's the 1990 Night of the Living Dead, the Tom Savini one. I just thought that since you'd seen it recently, you might have talked about it. But
it's good. I liked it.
It is good. I'm sorry, you had the criteria that you had to like it better. Okay.
No, that was
No, that was Christopher.
That was me.
Okay.
That was me.
And then we get to six was Psycho, five was Batman Begins, four is The Departed, three is Casino Royale, two is Star Trek, number one is The Little Shop of Horrors, yes, President Obvious Strikes Again. And that is going to bring an end to our discussion of our favorite remakes of all time. I had fun with this list, and you have no soul, Ethan.
Yep, and Vice President Obvious here is plotting to assassinate President Obvious to take his position, apparently.
Well, whatever.
Maybe I'll feed you to a giant alien plant.
I'd be okay with that, especially if it's sang. You know me, I like musicals. But stay tuned, we're going to be right back with our outro section. Had a discussion with Christopher McLaughlin about our favorite remakes / reboots of all time. Was this as painful as you thought it would be, sir?
Well, it did actually find us, I think, in a somewhat crankier mood than before. But
do we need to reboot or remake this episode?
No, I don't.
I thought that was the plan for next week.
Oh,
like the three of us were just going to put in like really quick cameo appearances, and like the three sexier, younger versions of us were going to do it.
We'll get the we'll get the Bagman Board guys to do the show instead.
They are younger than us, so there you go.
And we'll make cameos, and then we'll just do
their. We'll play Rachel in their show. We'll be the ones that come in and interrupt us near towards the end, make a bunch of noise.
and we'll be we can be the cats that fight in the back.
There you go. We can do that. We can argue about Little Shop of Horrors in the background. We can do that.
Or maybe they'll save us for the post-credit sequence.
Yeah, we can be all like, "Hey, you forgot about us." But actually, I had fun with this list because it made me realize that when it comes down to it, films are just supposed to be fun, and we can be movie snobs about it all we want. But when it comes down to it, we should be enjoying this instead of, you know, standing and being snobby about things. But that does bring an end to this week. Next week, we are going to be back with a special guest host, and we are going to be topical again. That's, what, twice? Three times in a year?
Whoa.
Like this year alone.
We're topical again, like a cream.
Yeah, topical like a cream. Yeah, at the beginning of the year, we did favorite...
Be sure to rub some Confessions of a Movie Snob cream all over you next time.
Ew. But what we're doing is we're talking... this coming Tuesday is the Oscar nominations.
We just made Rachel lose it. It's very funny.
That is funny. But the Oscar nominations are on Tuesday, Ethan.
They are.
And because of that, we're going to be topical, and we're going to be talking our...
Are we announcing them at like 4 a.m. or something?
Some shit like that. I'll find it later.
I'm going to be sleeping.
Yeah, so, me too. Yeah. I'll find it later. They're going to be... They don't go away at 4 a.m.
This Oscar season, I do intend to try to watch every movie that is up for Best Picture.
Well, I hope there's only 5 nominees.
Hey, you know, if there's not, there's not. I said I'm going to try.
Well, so I'll try, too. So far, I've seen potentially none of them, unless, like, they pull a weirdo and throw, like, you know, 50-50 up there, the Muppets or something weird like that.
That'd be great.
Yeah. But
it's Captain America, Super 8.
But we're going to be doing a list. We're going to be doing a list that, I say it often that I had a lot of trouble with these lists. This is one I've already started working on, and I'm glad I started on it early because this is devastatingly difficult to do. It's going to be our top 6 favorite best pictures of all time. As of, you know, this recording, I've now got it narrowed down to about 15 that I could choose for my number one. So this is going to be rough because there's some, I mean, not to sound stupid, but we're doing the best of the best and the best of the last.
Christopher is, of course, that's going to be my number one. Best of the best.
Best of the best.
Entry.
Yep.
Christopher, of course, is probably sitting back going, "God, I'm glad I don't have to do that list."
Yeah.
Yes, and matter of fact, I actually am.
Because
our guests, our hosts, no matter if they're on the show, it's like, you still have to do the list.
Yeah. Yeah. Just let us know. Yeah. Get an email to us.
I'll get right on that.
See, your thing about it probably is none of these movies are any good. My thing about it is there's a lot of movies that are really good.
I went through, I was getting the list ready for today.
Yeah.
And I've only seen 31 movies that have been nominated, that have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll go through and tweak it next week. But,
Man, I've seen them all, so that sucks.
So Shakespeare in Love is number one.
Yeah. Yeah, out of none. I hate
Followed
that freaking movie.
American Beauty and...
I like American Beauty. It's probably not going to be on my list, but I like it.
And followed by The English Patient, right?
Fuck no. That might be my dead... No, that wouldn't even be my dead last. I think my dead last would be like American in Paris or something like that, because that's the one that beat out High Noon, and that pisses me off. But this is all stuff we should be talking about next week.
That's true.
When we talk our...
The continued conversation next week.
Yeah, but... Christopher, you're always a joy to have on, and never, ever, ever take the fact that I disagree with you to mean that I have nothing but respect for you, because I just, you know, I mean, I'm really happy that you don't like the Star Trek remake, because that means that you like something else.
I can say without a shadow of a doubt that I have the utmost respects for James Lauder. I mean,
Are we going to go there again? But, you know, I'm glad you didn't like it, and I don't, you know, because you obviously have a lot invested in Star Trek. I could care less about this movie. I just thought it was, you know, relatively well done. And I'll concede to your knowledge, because I couldn't make it past season 3 of Next Gen because it was boring and they talked about microwaves and crap too much. But thank you very much for being on the show. You're always a pleasure to have on.
And always a great honor and pleasure for me, gentlemen. I thank you very much.
Well, until next week when we're talking the best of the best, I'm Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
I'm going to let the plan eat you.
I'm gonna let my geek flag fly.
Yeah, we can do that too.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole. The old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away. But I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down.